Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Context of white supremacy. Justice, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date is Friday, June 14th, 2013. We will be back, white people permitting, Saturday, that would be tomorrow, June 15th, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, the compensatory call in. It has been an interesting week. Most weeks are. Anti-blackness continuing. Calls to rape a black political elected official or appointed official in Italy. The assaults on President Obama continue. Another black person in Chicago harassed by white university officials reminded me of the incident in Northwestern. Just typical trashy, trifling week on the plantation. We even had the UFC fighter that called LeBron James a dork on television and talked about how wacky he was and that he'd smack him in the face if he saw him out in public. It's been another trashy week. Tune in tomorrow. Workplace triumphs, problems, dial in, please share. Tomorrow evening, compensatory call in. Before we kickstart the book session, we missed our scheduled broadcast for this past Monday. I believe that was June 10th. Dr. Robert Moore III was supposed to be our guest. He is the author of They Always Said I Would Marry a White Girl. He canceled on us just a few hours before we were supposed to go live the day of the broadcast. Very unprofessional, in my opinion. He is a victim of racism, white supremacy, but he did cancel. That's why we didn't have the broadcast. Was looking forward to discussing his book on the program. I think some listeners had even read his book. I will share a segment from the book before we get started. This is from They Always Said I Would Marry a White Girl. Sometimes you just let the record speak for itself. This is from page 48. One day on the playground, when I was in the fourth grade, I was being taunted pretty severely by two kids in fifth or sixth grade. I may have been shy and didn't know how to react. John, who was white and also my best friend, interceded on my behalf. I don't remember fists being thrown, but there was contact of some sort. John was a tough kid, perhaps large for his age. They never disturbed me again. Later that year, I went to visit John at his house after school. Although I was young, I had a sense of neighborhood boundaries. Like my own middle-class neighborhood, this area where John lived was solid working class and blue collar, and did not have one single African American. Perhaps touching on a stereotype, John's neighborhood seemed tougher than mine. Even today, when I drive through this area, I remember how I felt when I was young. The only difference now is there is a great diversity in that area. I never thought that African American families would ever live there, but now some do. Perhaps my optimism is tempered by the fact that this area and where I grew up is now considered to be part of the older suburbs, one of the inner ring suburbs closest to Philadelphia. As African Americans have pushed out, many whites have left, presumably, to the deeper suburbs or out of metro America altogether. I had visited John before, but on this occasion, a couple doors before I reached my destination, I was approached and taunted by a group of four or five kids, some of whom I recognized from my elementary school, in grades other than my own. They blocked my path, spit a couple times on my bike, and generally harassed me by asking me why I was in their neighborhood. They didn't attack me physically, but I remember feeling outnumbered and thinking they were capable of actually striking me if I talked back, in quotes. The only recourse was to simply wait until they were done. While these kids were taunting me, I noticed John start to come out of his house. I also saw his mother peek outside above his head. She quickly pulled John back inside. My only hope to escape these kids was now gone, safely tucked away in his house. I never forgot that incident. John's mother, perhaps sensing I was an unwanted by the neighborhood bullies and unable to resist the will of the masses, pulled her son to safety. I think one of our incredibly generous investors, she operates Interstanding Business. Check it out, Blog Talk Radio. She has said consistently, racist man, racist woman, racist child. What to say? Very interesting read, which once again just further substantiates everything that myself, Pam, Neely Fuller Jr., Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing, and so many others, Dr. Baruti, have said about the incorrectness of sexual intercourse between white people, racists, and non-whites. It is the worst possible thing in the world. Moving forward, the book today, Dale Carnegie. Over 15 million copies sold and counting. Published in 1936, one of the first quote unquote self-help books published. What to say? Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. I'm really looking forward to this study session. I think there are a wealth of great suggestions on ways to minimize conflict and have more quality relationship communication with other people. I have used a lot of these strategies. In fact, the first time I read this book was shortly after I had become informed about racism, white supremacy, familiar with Mr. Fuller's work. I think about a year after I read Mr. Fuller's work. That's exact timing. About a year after I first read Mr. Fuller's work and had been publicly talking about racism, white supremacy, and having different arguments and having people get mad and lots of conflict and being threatened, and a lot of which continues. And I said, I'm going to read this book and see if there are some tips that I can use that will be helpful to me so that I have less conflict. It's already going to be conflict just because you're talking about white supremacy, racism, which is war, terrorism. There got to be some things I can do with words that will help keep me safe, constructive, and improve communication. This book has played a huge part in that. And in fact, I think you will recognize some of the techniques that I use and a lot of other people. It's not just me. I think a lot of the folks that are effective communicating about racism, white supremacy with other individuals, white and non-white, I think you'll see that they use a lot of the methods that are suggested in this text. I look at it as a code, a conversation code, communication code for how to have quality relationships, communication with other people. I'll give you a quick example before we begin the audio segment. This past weekend, I can't really say it was a vacation because it was really just like I got 24 hours. I was even going to say to relax, but even that wouldn't be truthful because I was preparing. I went to do research and I got some great info. I found articles I had been searching for, and then I was preparing for the program with Dr. Moore, which didn't happen. But within that space, I also got some time. I was hanging out with other non-white people, victims of racism, non-black, non-white people. We watched Game of Thrones. Wow. As I had said before, a lot of times if you're around non-white people, you end up being in front of the television, and that's just going to be racism, white supremacy out the wazoo, which it was. So we watched Game of Thrones, and then they decide to watch the movie Think Like a Man. I don't know if people are familiar with this. Gabrielle Union is in it. Megan Good. Kevin Hart, Steve Harvey, Wendy Williams, Ron Artest, Lisa Leslie. There's some other folks, I'm sure. I think Maurice Chestnut is in it. At any rate, I think it came out in 2012. I had never seen this film. I had no interest in seeing this film. I heard about it when it came out, and it just looked kind of silly. Just a lot of black silliness. I've seen a lot of these sort of films where it's kind of a romance comedy with a lot of kind of goofy humor, kind of all the way back. I was thinking Boomerang, The Wood, The Best Man, Love and Basketball. It's been a lot of these type, and I'm not, you know, saying that there's anything wrong with any of these films. Just I've seen a lot of those type of films, and you know, I'm that's not the sort of film that I'm interested in seeing at this point. Yes, Gabrielle Union is, you know, gorgeous, wowie, but you know, I don't need to see Think Like a Man. So we're watching this film with two individuals who have classified as not black at various times in their life. And so we're watching this movie, all black or mostly black cast, and I'm just, oh my gosh, like, this is the anti-blackness abounds. Like, they've got this black comedian, Kevin Hart, victim of racism, and he's just doing a lot of the same tired minstrel stuff. When Mr. Fuller says anytime he sees a black comedian, it's going to be a black person coming out on stage with the microphone, he immediately changes the channel. Like, this is one of those times. So I employ these techniques. This is an opportunity where I could have had a white supremacy stress reaction because it was really bothering me. I could have, you know, done some cursing. I could have done some jumping up and down, and I can't believe you're watching this. One of you's read Mr. Fuller's work. This is, you know, an abomination, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, I could have done all that, but I didn't. You know, I was able to stay composed, and I waited. And I picked my spots until they finished. I've even heard Mr. Fuller say that. He said, if you're watching a movie with other victims and you see aspects of racism, white supremacy, don't talk through the movie trying to point it out, no matter how excited you get, no matter how frustrated, because people just get upset. They want to watch the movie. They don't want to hear your analysis of their racist fodder. You know, they're enjoying it. They might even get mad at you for trying to point it out. So he said, wait. And then that's exactly what I did. I waited patiently. I got a beer. I got several beers. And I waited. And once it ended, and we had dialogue, and I said that before, you can just ask a question. And I asked a few questions about it. And they gave their analysis. And then when I was given an opportunity to speak, I immediately went to one observation, and I said, Gabrielle Union, who is phenomenally gorgeous, she looks like a teenager, and she's 40. She, in this film, is in a sexual relationship with someone that I think is a white person. In this film, it's a romance comedy. There are a lot of male-female dating arrangements going on. Most of them, it's a black male, black female. Gabrielle Union is with a white man. At the end of the film, after all of the chaos and strife and fighting and breaking up and blah, 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 at the end of the film, everybody is happily together. However, you only get one proposal at the end of Think Like a Man. The proposal is the white man proposing to the black female, and he offers to buy her a house. Nobody else proposes. Nobody else gets a house. You have one black male and one black female. Their happy ending is they're just hugging and smiling in a kitchen, in the back of a kitchen, next to the stove, basically. The other couple, I think, they just have a declaration of their love publicly. And I think the other couple, it's something similar, but only one of the couples, and I could be mistaken, I was having a very difficult time watching this film, but that stood out to me immediately. And when I pointed this out, At least one of the other people said, oh yeah, I did notice that, and it was the white person. Wow, what is that? And I said, yeah, exactly. And that's just one illustration that I can give. Might not be the best example, and it may not have been the maybe the best thing at this point is to jump up and down and act a fool, although I tend to think that's not constructive. I've seen that a lot, and it just tends to be either an argument or people look at you like you're crazy. Get out of the way. I'm trying to watch, you know, real basketball wives or whatever it is that they, you know, precious, whatever, insert television show, film. At any rate, I think we should all be looking for the most effective ways to share information so that it is heard, processed, and stored in the brain computers of other non-white people when we communicate, not that they immediately put up their blocker, their white traffic cop becomes, you know, the size of a giant and leaps out and is blocking all of your constructive information. Like, get out of here, go away, nigga. You don't want that. You want it to be so that this information is saved, stored, filed away in their brain computer, even if they're just thinking about it. That's what you want, and I think this book will give us a lot of fantastic suggestions that we can utilize to reduce conflict, make sure that we are heard when we attempt to share constructive counter-racist material. Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, Context of White Supremacy.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Read by Andrew McMillan.
How this book was written and why. During the first 35 years of the 20th century, the publishing houses of America printed more than a fifth of a million different books. Most of them were deadly dull, and many were financial failures. Many, did I say? The president of one of the largest publishing houses in the world confessed to me that his company, after 75 years of publishing experience, still lost money on 7 out of every 8 books it published. Why, then, did I have the temerity to write another book? And after I had written it, why should you bother to read it? Fair questions both, and I'll try to answer them. I have, since 1912, been conducting educational courses for business and professional men and women in New York. At first, I conducted courses in public speaking only, courses designed to train adults by actual experience to think on their feet and express their ideas with more clarity, more effectiveness, and more poise, both in business interviews and before groups. But gradually, as the seasons passed, I realized that as sorely as these adults needed training in effective speaking, they needed still more training in the fine art of getting along with people in everyday business and social contacts. I also gradually realized that I was sorely in need of such training myself. As I look back across the years, I'm appalled at my own frequent lack of finesse and understanding. How I wish a book such as this had been placed in my hands 20 years ago. What a priceless boon it would have been. Dealing with people is probably the biggest problem you face, especially if you're in business. Yes, and that is also true if you are a housewife, architect, or engineer. Research done a few years ago under the auspices of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching uncovered a most important and significant fact. A fact later confirmed by additional studies made at the Carnegie Institute of Technology. These investigations revealed that even in such technical lines as engineering, about 15% of one's financial success is due to one's technical knowledge, and about 85% is due to skill in human engineering, to personality, and the ability to lead people. For many years, I conducted courses each season at the Engineers Club of Philadelphia, and also courses for the New York chapter of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. A total of probably more than 1,500 engineers have passed through my classes. They came to me because they had finally realized, after years of observation and experience, that the highest paid personnel in engineering are frequently not those who know the most about engineering. One can, for example, hire mere technical ability in engineering, accountancy, architecture, or any other profession at nominal salaries. But the person who has technical knowledge plus the ability to express ideas, to assume leadership, and to arouse enthusiasm among people, that person is headed for higher earning power. In the heyday of his activity, John D. Rockefeller said that the ability to deal with people is as purchasable a commodity as sugar or coffee. "And I will pay more for that ability," said John D., "than for any other under the sun." Wouldn't you suppose that every college in the land would conduct courses to develop the highest-priced ability under the sun? But if there is just one practical, common-sense course of that kind given for adults in even one college in the land, it has escaped my attention up to the present writing. The University of Chicago and the United YMCA schools conducted a survey to determine what adults want to study. That survey cost $25,000 and took 2 years. The last part of the survey was made in Meriden, Connecticut. It had been chosen as a typical American town. Every adult in Meriden was interviewed and requested to answer 156 questions. Questions such as, what is your business or profession? Your education? How do you spend your spare time? What is your income? Your hobbies? Your ambitions? Your problems? What subjects are you most interested in studying? And so on. That survey revealed that health is the prime interest of adults, and that their second interest is people. How to understand and get along with people, how to make people like you, and how to win others to your way of thinking. So the committee conducting this survey resolved to conduct such a course for adults in Meriden. They searched diligently for a practical textbook on the subject and found not one. Finally, they approached one of the world's outstanding authorities on adult education and asked him if he knew of any book that met the needs of this group. "No," he replied. "I know what those adults want, but the book they need has never been written." I knew from experience that this statement was true, for I myself had been searching for years to discover a practical working handbook on human relations. Since no such book existed, I have tried to write one for use in my own courses. And here it is. I hope you like it. In preparation for this book, I read everything that I could find on the subject. Everything from newspaper columns, magazine articles, records of the family courts, the writings of the old philosophers, and the new psychologists. In addition, I hired a trained researcher to spend 1.5 years in various libraries reading everything I had missed, plowing through erudite tomes on psychology, poring over hundreds of magazine articles, searching through countless biographies, trying to ascertain how the great leaders of all ages had dealt with people. We read their biographies. We read the life stories of all great leaders from Julius Caesar to Thomas Edison. I recall that we read over 100 biographies of Theodore Roosevelt alone. We were determined to spare no time, no expense, to discover every practical idea that anyone had ever used throughout the ages for winning friends and influencing people. I personally interviewed scores of successful people, some of them world-famous, inventors like Marconi and Edison, political leaders like Franklin D. Roosevelt and James Farley, business leaders like Owen D. Young, movie stars like Clark Gable and Mary Pickford, and explorers like Martin Johnson, and tried to discover the techniques they used in human relations. From all this material, I prepared a short talk. I called it How to Win Friends and Influence People. I say short. It was short in the beginning, but it soon expanded to a lecture that consumed 1 hour and 30 minutes. For years, I gave this talk each season to the adults in the Carnegie Institute courses in New York. I gave the talk and urged the listeners to go out and test it in their business and social contacts, and then come back to class and speak about their experiences and the results they'd achieved. What an interesting assignment! These men and women, hungry for self-improvement, were fascinated by the idea of working in a new kind of laboratory, the first and only laboratory of human relationships for adults that had ever existed. This book wasn't written in the usual sense of the word. It grew as a child grows. It grew and developed out of that laboratory, out of the experiences of thousands of adults. Years ago, we started with a set of rules printed on a card no larger than a postcard. The next season, we printed a larger card, then a leaflet, then a series of booklets, each one expanding in size and scope. After 15 years of experiment and research came this book. The rules we have set down here are not mere theories or guesswork. They work like magic. Incredible as it sounds, I have seen the application of these principles literally revolutionize the lives of many people. To illustrate, a man with 314 employees joined one of these courses. For years, he had driven and criticized and condemned his employees without stint or discretion. Kindness, words of appreciation and encouragement were alien to his lips. After studying the principles discussed in this book, this employer sharply altered his philosophy of life. His organization is now inspired with a new loyalty, a new enthusiasm, a new spirit of teamwork. 314 enemies have been turned into 314 friends. As he proudly said in a speech before the class, "When I used to walk through my establishment, no one greeted me. My employees actually looked the other way when they saw me approaching. But now, they are all my friends, and even the janitor calls me by my first name." This employer gained more profit, more leisure, and what is infinitely more important, he found far more happiness in his business and in his home. Countless numbers of salespeople have sharply increased their sales by the use of these principles. Many have opened up new accounts, accounts that they had formerly solicited in vain. Executives have been given increased authority, increased pay. One executive reported a large increase in salary because he applied these truths. Another, an executive in the Philadelphia Gas Works Company, was slated for demotion when he was 65 because of his belligerence, because of his inability to lead people skillfully. This training not only saved him from the demotion, but brought him a promotion with increased pay. On innumerable occasions, spouses attending the banquet given at the end of the course have told me that their homes have been much happier since their husbands or wives started this training. People are frequently astonished at the new results they achieve. It all seems like magic. In some cases, in their enthusiasm, they have telephoned me at my home on Sundays because they couldn't wait 48 hours to report their achievements at the regular session of the course. One man was so stirred by a talk on these principles that he sat far into the night discussing them with other members of the class. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the others went home, but he was so shaken by a realization of his own mistakes, so inspired by the vista of a new and richer world opening before him, that he was unable to sleep. He didn't sleep that night, or the next day, or the next night. Who was he? A naive, untrained individual, ready to gush over any new theory that came along? No, far from it. He was a sophisticated, blasé dealer in art, very much the man about town, who spoke three languages fluently and was a graduate of two European universities. While writing this chapter, I received a letter from a German of the old school, an aristocrat whose forebears had served for generations as professional army officers under the Hohenzollerns. His letter, written from a transatlantic steamer, telling about the application of these principles, rose almost to a religious fervor. Another man, an old New Yorker, a Harvard graduate, a wealthy man, the owner of a large carpet factory, declared he had learned more in 14 weeks through this system of training about the fine art of influencing people than he had learned about the same subject during his 4 years in college. Absurd? Laughable? Fantastic? Of course, you are privileged to dismiss this statement with whatever adjective you wish. I am merely reporting, without comment, a declaration made by a conservative and eminently successful Harvard graduate in a public address to approximately 600 people at the Yale Club in New York on the evening of Thursday, February 23, 1933. "Compared to what we ought to be," said the famous professor William James of Harvard, "compared to what we ought to be, we are only half awake. we are making use of only a small part of our physical and mental resources. Stating the thing broadly, the human individual thus lives far within his limits. He possesses powers of various sorts which he habitually fails to use. Those powers which you habitually fail to use. The sole purpose of this book is to help you discover, develop, and profit by those dormant and unused assets. Education, said Dr. John G. Hibben, former president of Princeton University, is the ability to meet life situations. If by the time you have finished listening to the first three chapters of this book, if you aren't then a little better equipped to meet life situations, then I shall consider this book to be a total failure so far as you are concerned. For the great aim of education, said Herbert Spencer, is not knowledge, but action. And this is an action book. How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Part 1. Fundamental Techniques in Handling People. Chapter 1. If you want to gather honey, don't kick over the beehive. On May 7, 1931, the most sensational manhunt New York City had ever known had come to its climax. After weeks of search, Two-Gun Crowley, the killer, the gunman who didn't smoke or drink, was at bay, trapped in his sweetheart's apartment on West End Avenue. 150 policemen and detectives laid siege to his top-floor hideaway. They chopped holes in the roof. They tried to smoke out Crowley, the cop killer, with tear gas. Then they mounted their machine guns on surrounding buildings, and for more than an hour, one of New York's fine residential areas reverberated with a crack of pistol fire and the rat-tat-tat of machine guns. Crowley, crouching behind an overstuffed chair, fired incessantly at the police. 10,000 excited people watched the battle. Nothing like it had ever been seen before on the sidewalks of New York. When Crowley was captured, Police Commissioner E.P. Mulrooney declared that the two-gun desperado was one of the most dangerous criminals ever encountered in the history of New York. He will kill, said the commissioner, at the drop of a feather. But how did Two-Gun Crowley regard himself? We know, because while the police were firing into his apartment, he wrote a letter addressed to whom it may concern. And as he wrote, the blood flowing from his wounds left a crimson trail on the paper. In this letter, Crowley said, "Under my coat is a weary heart, but a kind one, one that would do nobody any harm." A short time before this, Crowley had been having a necking party with his girlfriend on a country road out on Long Island. Suddenly a policeman walked up to the car and said, "Let me see your license." Without saying a word, Crowley drew his gun and cut the policeman down with a shower of lead. As the dying officer fell, Crowley leaped out of the car, grabbed the officer's revolver, and fired another bullet into the prostrate body. And that was the killer who said, "Under my coat is a weary heart, but a kind one, one that would do nobody any harm." Crowley was sentenced to the electric chair. When he arrived at the death house in Sing Sing, did he say, "This is what I get for killing people"? No, he said, "This is what I get for defending myself." The point of the story is this. Two-Gun Crowley didn't blame himself for anything. Is that an unusual attitude among criminals? If you think so, listen to this. "I have spent the best years of my life giving people the lighter pleasures, helping them have a good time, and all I get is abuse, the existence of a hunted man." That's Al Capone speaking. Yes, America's most notorious public enemy, the most sinister gang leader who ever shot up Chicago. Capone didn't condemn himself. He actually regarded himself as a public benefactor, an unappreciated and misunderstood public benefactor. And so did Dutch Schultz before he crumpled up under gangster bullets in Newark. Dutch Schultz, one of New York's most notorious rats, said in a newspaper interview that he was a public benefactor, and he believed it. I've had some interesting correspondence with Louis Laws, who was warden of New York's infamous Sing Sing prison for many years, on this subject, and he declared that few of the criminals in Sing Sing regard themselves as bad men. They are just as human as you and I. So they rationalize, they explain. They can tell you why they had to crack a safe or be quick on the trigger finger. Most of them attempt by a form of reasoning, fallacious or logical, to justify their antisocial acts even to themselves, consequently stoutly maintaining that they should never have been imprisoned at all. If Al Capone, Two Gun Crowley, Dutch Schultz, and the desperate men and women behind prison walls don't blame themselves for anything, what about the people with whom you and I come in contact? John Wanamaker, founder of the stores that bear his name, once confessed, "I learned 30 years ago that it is foolish to scold." I have enough trouble overcoming my own limitations without fretting over the fact that God has not seen fit to distribute evenly the gift of intelligence. Wanamaker learned this lesson early, but I personally had to blunder through this old world for a third of a century before it even began to dawn upon me that 99 times out of 100, people don't criticize themselves for anything, no matter how wrong it may be. Criticism is futile, because it puts a person on the defensive and usually makes him strive to justify himself. Criticism is dangerous because it wounds a person's precious pride, hurts his sense of importance, and arouses resentment. B.F. Skinner, the world-famous psychologist, proved through his experiments that an animal rewarded for good behavior will learn much more rapidly and retain what it learns far more effectively than an animal punished for bad behavior. Later studies have shown that the same applies to humans. By criticizing, we do not make lasting changes and often incur resentment. Hans Selye, another great psychologist, said, "As much as we thirst for approval, we dread condemnation." The resentment that criticism engenders can demoralize employees, family members, and friends, and still not correct the situation that has been condemned. George B. Johnston of Enid, Oklahoma, is the safety coordinator for an engineering company. One of his responsibilities is to see that employees wear their hard hats whenever they are on a job in the field. He reported that whenever he came across workers who were not wearing hard hats, he would tell them with a lot of authority of the regulation and that they must comply. As a result, he would get sullen acceptance, and often after he left, the workers would remove the hats. He decided to try a different approach. The next time he found some of the workers not wearing their hard hat, he asked if the hats were uncomfortable or didn't fit properly. Then he reminded the men in a pleasant tone of voice that the hat was designed to protect them from injury and suggested that it always be worn on the job. The result was increased compliance with the regulation with no resentment or emotional upset. You will find examples of the futility of criticism bristling on 1,000 pages of history. Take, for example, the famous quarrel between Theodore Roosevelt and President Taft, a quarrel that split the Republican Party, put Woodrow Wilson in the White House, and wrote bold, luminous lines across the First World War and altered the flow of history. Now let's review the facts quickly. When Theodore Roosevelt stepped out of the White House in 1908, he supported Taft, who was elected president. Then Theodore Roosevelt went off to Africa to shoot lions. When he returned, he exploded. He denounced Taft for his conservatism, tried to secure the nomination for a third term himself, formed the Bull Moose Party, and all but demolished the GOP. In the election that followed, William Howard Taft and the Republican Party carried only two states, Vermont and Utah, the most disastrous defeat the party had ever known. Theodore Roosevelt blamed Taft, but did President Taft blame himself? Of course not. With tears in his eyes, Taft said, "I don't see how I could have done any differently from what I have." Who was to blame, Roosevelt or Taft? Frankly, I don't know, and I don't care. The point I'm trying to make is that all of Theodore Roosevelt's criticism didn't persuade Taft that he was wrong. It merely made Taft strive to justify himself and to reiterate with tears in his eyes, "I don't see how I could have done any differently from what I have." Or take the Teapot Dome oil scandal. It kept the newspapers ringing with indignation in the early 1920s. It rocked the nation. Within the memory of living men, nothing like it had ever happened before in American public life. Now, here are the bare facts of the scandal. Albert B. Fall, Secretary of the Interior in Harding's cabinet, was entrusted with the leasing of government oil reserves at Elk Hill and Teapot Dome, oil reserves that had been set aside for the future of the Navy. Did Secretary Fall permit competitive bidding? No, sir. He handed the fat, juicy contract outright to his friend Edward L. Doheny. What did Doheny do? He gave Secretary Fall what he was pleased to call a loan of $100,000. Then, in a high-handed manner, Secretary Fall ordered United States Marines into the district to drive off competitors whose adjacent wells were sapping oil out of the Elk Hill reserves. These competitors, driven off their ground at the ends of guns and bayonets, rushed into court and blew the lid off the Teapot Dome scandal. A stench arose so vile that it ruined the Harding administration, nauseated an entire nation, threatened to wreck the Republican Party, and put Albert B. Fall behind prison bars. Fall was condemned viciously, condemned as few men in public life have ever been. Did he repent? Never. Years later, Herbert Hoover intimated in a public speech that President Harding's death had been due to mental anxiety and worry because a friend had betrayed him. When Mrs. Fall heard that, she sprang from her chair. She wept. She shook her fists at fate and screamed, "What? Harding betrayed by Fall? No, my husband never betrayed anyone. This whole house full of gold would not tempt my husband to do wrong. He is the one who has been betrayed and led to the slaughter and crucified." And there you are. Human nature in action. Wrongdoers blaming everybody but themselves. We are all like that. So when you and I are tempted to criticize someone tomorrow, let's remember Al Capone, Two Gun Crowley, and Albert Fall. Let's realize that criticisms are like homing pigeons. They always return home. Let's realize that the person we're going to correct and condemn will probably justify himself or herself and condemn us in return. Or, like the gentle Taft, will say, "I don't see how I could have done any differently from what I have." On the morning of April 15th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln lay dying in a hall bedroom of a cheap lodging house directly across the street from Ford's Theater, where John Wilkes Booth had shot him. Lincoln's long body lay stretched diagonally across a sagging bed that was too short for him. A cheap reproduction of Rosa Bonheur's famous painting, The Horse Fair, hung above the bed, and a dismal gas jet flickered yellow light. As Lincoln lay dying, Secretary of War Stanton said, "There lies the most perfect ruler of men that the world has ever seen." What was the secret of Lincoln's success in dealing with people? I studied the life of Abraham Lincoln for 10 years and devoted all of 3 years to writing and rewriting a book entitled Lincoln the Unknown. I believe I have made as detailed and exhaustive a study of Lincoln's personality and home life as it is possible for any being to make. I made a special study of Lincoln's method of dealing with people. Did he indulge in criticism? Oh, yes. As a young man in the Pigeon Creek Valley of Indiana, he not only criticized, but he wrote letters and poems ridiculing people and dropped these letters on the country roads where they were sure to be found. One of these letters aroused resentments that burned for a lifetime. Even after Lincoln had become a practicing lawyer in Springfield, Illinois, he attacked his opponents openly in letters published in the newspapers. But he did this just once too often. In the autumn of 1842, he ridiculed a vain, pugnacious politician by the name of James Shields. Lincoln lampooned him through an anonymous letter published in the Springfield Journal. The town roared with laughter. Shields, sensitive and proud, boiled with indignation. He found out who wrote the letter, leapt on his horse, started after Lincoln, and challenged him to fight a duel. Lincoln didn't want to fight. He was opposed to dueling, but he couldn't get out of it and save his honor. He was given the choice of weapons. Since he had very long arms, he chose cavalry broadswords and took lessons in sword fighting from a West Point graduate. And on the appointed day, he and Shields met on a sandbar in the Mississippi River, prepared to fight to the death. But at the last minute, their seconds interrupted and stopped the duel. And that was the most lurid personal incident in Lincoln's life. It taught him an invaluable lesson in the art of dealing with people. Never again did he write an insulting letter. Never again did he ridicule anyone. And from that time on, he almost never criticized anybody for anything. Time after time during the Civil War, Lincoln put a new general at the head of the Army of the Potomac, and each one in turn, McClellan, Pope, Burnside, Hooker, Meade, blundered tragically and drove Lincoln to pacing the floor in despair. Half the nation savagely condemned these incompetent generals, but Lincoln, with malice toward none and charity for all, held his peace. One of his favorite quotations was, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." And when Mrs. Lincoln and others spoke harshly of the Southern people, Lincoln replied, "Don't criticize them. They are just what we would be under similar circumstances." Yet if any man ever had occasion to criticize, surely it was Lincoln. Let's take just one illustration. The Battle of Gettysburg was fought during the first 3 days of July, 1863. During the night of July 4th, Lee began to retreat southward while storm clouds deluged the country with rain. When Lee reached the Potomac with his defeated army, he found a swollen, impassable river in front of him and a victorious Union army behind him. Lee was in a trap. He couldn't escape. Lincoln saw that. Here was a golden, heaven-sent opportunity, the opportunity to capture Lee's army and end the war immediately. So, with a surge of high hope, Lincoln ordered Meade not to call a council of war, but to attack Lee immediately. Lincoln telegraphed his orders and then sent a special messenger to Meade demanding immediate action. And what did General Meade do? He did the very opposite of what he was told to do. He called a council of war in direct violation of Lincoln's orders. He hesitated. He procrastinated. He telegraphed all manner of excuses. He refused point blank to attack Lee. Finally, the waters receded, and Lee escaped over the Potomac with his forces. Lincoln was furious. "What does this mean?" Lincoln cried to his son Robert. "Great God, what does this mean? We had them within our grasp, and had only to stretch forth our hands, and they were ours. Yet nothing that I could say or do could make the army move." Under the circumstances, almost any general could have defeated Lee. If I had gone up there, I could have whipped him myself. In bitter disappointment, Lincoln sat down and wrote Meade this letter. And remember, at this period of his life, Lincoln was extremely conservative and restrained in his phraseology. So this letter, coming from Lincoln in 1863, was tantamount to the severest rebuke. "My dear General, I do not believe you appreciate the magnitude of the misfortune involved in Lee's escape. He was within our easy grasp, and to have closed upon him would, in connection with our other late successes, have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely. If you could not safely attack Lee last Monday, how can you possibly do so south of the river, when you can take with you very few, no more than two-thirds of the force you then had in hand? It would be unreasonable to expect, and I do not expect, that you can now effect much. Your golden opportunity is gone, and I am distressed immeasurably because of it." What do you suppose Meade did when he read the letter? Meade never saw that letter. Lincoln never mailed it. It was found among his papers after his death. My guess is, and this is only a guess, that after writing that letter, Lincoln looked out of the window and said to himself, "Just a minute. Maybe I ought not to be so hasty. It is easy enough for me to sit here in the quiet of the White House and order Meade to attack. But if I had been up at Gettysburg, and if I had seen as much blood as Meade had seen during the last week, and if my ears had been pierced with the screams and the shrieks of the wounded and dying, maybe I wouldn't have been so anxious to attack either. If I had Meade's timid temperament, perhaps I would have done just what he had done. Anyhow, it is water under the bridge now. If I send this letter, it will relieve my feelings, but it will make Meade try to justify himself. It will make him condemn me. It will arouse hard feelings, impair all his further usefulness as a commander, and perhaps force him to resign from the army. So, as I've already said, Lincoln put the letter aside, for he'd learned by bitter experience that sharp criticisms and rebukes almost invariably end in futility. Theodore Roosevelt said that when he, as president, was confronted with a perplexing problem, he used to lean back and look up at a large painting of Lincoln, which hung above his desk in the White House, and ask himself, "What would Lincoln do if he were in my shoes? How would he solve this problem?" The next time we're tempted to admonish somebody, let's pull a $5 bill out of our pocket, look at Lincoln's picture on the bill, and ask, "How would Lincoln handle this problem if he had it?" Mark Twain lost his temper occasionally and wrote letters that turned the paper brown. For example, he once wrote to a man who'd aroused his ire, "The thing for you is a burial permit. You have only to speak, and I will see that you get it." On another occasion, he wrote to an editor about a proofreader's attempts to improve my spelling and punctuation. He ordered, "Set the matter according to my copy hereafter, and see that the proofreader retains his suggestions in the mush of his decayed brain." The writing of these stinging letters made Mark Twain feel better. They allowed him to blow off steam, and the letters didn't do any real harm because Mark's wife secretly lifted them out of the mail, and they were never sent. "Do you know someone you'd like to change and regulate and improve?" Good, that's fine. I'm all in favor of it. But why not begin on yourself? From a purely selfish standpoint, that's a lot more profitable than trying to improve others. Yes, and a lot less dangerous. "Don't complain about the snow on your neighbor's roof," said Confucius, "when your own doorstep is unclean." When I was still young and trying hard to impress people, I wrote a foolish letter to Richard Harding Davis, an author who once loomed large on the literary horizon of America. I was preparing a magazine article about authors. I asked Davis to tell me about his method of work. A few weeks earlier, I'd received a letter from someone with this notation at the bottom, "Dictated but not read." I was quite impressed. I felt that the writer must be very big and busy and important. I wasn't the slightest bit busy, but I was eager to make an impression on Richard Harding Davis, so I ended my short note with the words, "Dictated but not read." He never troubled to answer the letter. He simply returned it to me with this scribbled across the bottom: "Your bad manners are exceeded only by your bad manners." True, I had blundered, and perhaps I deserved this rebuke, but being human, I resented it. I resented it so sharply that when I read of the death of Richard Harding Davis 10 years later, the one thought that still persisted in my mind, I'm ashamed to admit, was the hurt that he had given me. If you and I want to stir up a resentment tomorrow that may rankle across the decades and endure until death, just let us indulge in a little stinging criticism, no matter how certain we are that it is justified. When dealing with people, let us remember, we are not dealing with creatures of logic. We are dealing with creatures of emotion, creatures bristling with prejudices and motivated by pride and vanity. Bitter criticism caused the sensitive Thomas Hardy, one of the finest novelists ever to enrich English literature, to give up forever the writing of fiction. Criticism drove Thomas Chatterton, the English poet, to suicide. Benjamin Franklin, tactless in his youth, became so diplomatic, so adroit at handling people, that he was made American ambassador to France. The secret of his success? "I will speak ill of no man," he said, "and speak all the good I know of everybody." Any fool can criticize, condemn, and complain, and most fools do. But it takes character and self-control to be understanding and forgiving. "A great man shows his greatness," said Carlyle, "by the way he treats little men." Bob Hoover, a famous test pilot and frequent performer at air shows, was returning to his home in Los Angeles from an air show in San Diego. As described in the magazine Flight Operations, at 300 feet in the air, both engines suddenly stopped. By deft maneuvering, he managed to land the plane, but it was badly damaged, although nobody was hurt. Hoover's first act after the emergency landing was to inspect the airplane's fuel. Just as he suspected, the World War II propeller plane he'd been flying had been fueled with jet fuel rather than gasoline. Upon returning to the airport, he asked to see the mechanic who had serviced his airplane. The young man was sick with the agony of his mistake. Tears streamed down his face as Hoover approached. He had just caused the loss of a very expensive plane and could have caused the loss of three lives as well. You can imagine Hoover's anger. One could anticipate a tongue-lashing that this proud and precise pilot would unleash for that carelessness. But Hoover didn't scold the mechanic. He didn't even criticize him. Instead, he put his big arm around the man's shoulder and said, "To show you I'm sure that you'll never do this again, I want you to service my F-51 tomorrow." Often parents are tempted to criticize their children. You would expect me to say, "Don't," but I will not. I am merely going to say, before you criticize them, read one of the classics of American journalism, Father Forgets. It originally appeared as an editorial in the People's Home Journal. Here it is, with the author's permission, as condensed in the Reader's Digest. A Father Forgets is one of those little pieces which, dashed off in a moment of sincere feeling, strikes an echoing chord in so many readers as to become a perennial reprint favorite. Since its first appearance, Father Forgets has been reproduced, writes the author W. Livingston Larned, in hundreds of magazines and house organs, and in newspapers all over the country. It has been reprinted almost as extensively in many foreign languages. I have given personal permission to thousands who wish to read it from school, church, and lecture platforms. It has been on the air on countless occasions and programs. Oddly enough, college periodicals have used it, and high school magazines. Sometimes a little piece seems mysteriously to click. This one certainly did. Father Forgets by W. Livingston Larned. Listen, son, I'm saying this as you lie asleep, one little paw curled under your cheek and the blonde curls stickily wet on your damp forehead. I have stolen into your room alone. Just a few minutes ago, as I sat reading my paper in the library, a stifling wave of remorse swept over me. Guiltily, I came to your bedside. These are the things I was thinking, son. I had been cross to you. I scolded you as you were dressing for school because you gave your face merely a dab with a towel. I took you to task for not cleaning your shoes. I called out angrily when you threw some of your things on the floor. At breakfast, I found fault, too. You spilled things. You gulped down your food. You put your elbows on the table. You spread butter too thick on your bread. And as you started off to play and I made for my train, you turned and waved a hand and called, "Goodbye, Daddy." And I frowned and said in reply, "Hold your shoulders back." Then it began all over again in the late afternoon. As I came up the road, I spied you down on your knees playing marbles. There were holes in your stockings. I humiliated you before your boyfriends by marching you ahead of me to the house. Stockings were expensive, and if you had to buy them, you'd be more careful. Imagine that, son, from a father. Do you remember later, when I was reading in the library, how you came in timidly with a sort of hurt look in your eyes? When I glanced up over my paper, impatient at the interruption, you hesitated at the door. "What is it you want?" I snapped. You said nothing, but ran across in one tempestuous plunge and threw your arms around my neck and kissed me, and your small arms tightened with an affection that God had set blooming in your heart and which even neglect could not wither. And then you were gone, pattering up the stairs. Well, son, it was shortly afterwards that my paper slipped from my hands and a terrible, sickening fear came over me. What has habit been doing to me, the habit of finding fault, of reprimanding? This was my reward to you for being a boy. It was not that I did not love you. It was that I expected too much of youth. I was measuring you by the yardstick of my own years. And there was so much that was good and fine and true in your character. The little heart of you was as big as the dawn itself over the wide hills. This was shown by your spontaneous impulse to rush in and kiss me goodnight. Nothing else matters tonight, son. I have come to your bedside in the darkness, and I have knelt there ashamed. It is a feeble atonement. I know you would not understand these things if I told them to you during your waking hours. But tomorrow, I will be a real daddy. I will chum with you, and suffer when you suffer, and laugh when you laugh. I will bite my tongue when impatient words come. I will keep saying, as if it were a ritual, he is nothing but a boy, a little boy. I am afraid I have visualized you as a man. Yet as I see you now, son, crumpled and weary in your cot, I see that you are still a baby. Yesterday you were in your mother's arms, your head on her shoulder. I have asked too much. Too much. Instead of condemning people, let's try to understand them. Let's try to figure out why they do what they do. That's a lot more profitable and intriguing than criticism, and it breeds sympathy, tolerance, and kindness. To know all is to forgive all. As Dr. Johnson said, God himself, sir, does not propose to judge man until the end of his days. Why should you and I? Principle 1. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial in is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. It had been a while, even though, if you have been listening to the Cows for a while, we had Dr. Khalif Muhammad on the program, I believe, last spring, May 2012, and we discussed this book and Never Be Lied To Again, two different books that offer techniques around words, how to pay attention to the words and nonverbal communication of others to pick up tips when someone might be trying to deceive you, and this book. Wow, it had been a while, so I think it had been about a year since I had read this book. I had got the audiobook about a year ago. It had been about a year since I listened to the audiobook. And just wow, every time I hear it, it's just like, oh yeah, I did really enjoy reading this book. Like, oh yeah, this book does have a lot of great suggestions. Like, it's just a treat. And as I have said, well, I actually don't say it very often. Because it's been my experience that it's something that generally promotes conflict, and most victims of racism do not agree, and it's something that you can't really prove. It's one of those truisms, I think. It's one of those things that you just have to come to understand. But I have concluded that to be white means to be racist. That's what it means to be a white person, to be racist. And you see that on display in the book as well, with the way that he speaks about even just the folks that end up being reference points for examples, whether it's Mr. Roosevelt and him going off to Africa to shoot lions, or the immortal Abraham Lincoln. Let's pull out our $5 bills for a reminder. With all of that, a lot of great information. I think we will review the number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We had folks who wrote in during the audio. We had one person, he's participated in a lot of our book study sessions and other calls, where he was saying that he thought this was a solid choice in terms of a book study session, even though he was kind of looking at Kindred, which is also a great book. Maybe we'll do that one down the road as well. But his thoughts on this one, he said he thought it was a brilliant choice because in books like this particular one, the keys to maintaining the system of white supremacy are carefully hidden inside. If we can spot them and discuss them, maybe we can come up with ways to disassemble or disable it. That was one. And then during the program, one of our other listeners wrote in Lincoln furious at General Meade. They wrote, those words by Lincoln were used by the character Gul Dukat, hope I'm saying it correctly, in the Star Trek DS9 episode, Sacrifice of Angels. White folks are really slick at pulling little bits of historical information commentary most aren't aware of and incorporating it into their works of popular fiction. Absolutely. They do this sort of thing all the time, forwards and backwards, even incorporating tidbits of things that they're going to be doing down the road where you'll see it in a film 5 or 10 years before it happens. At any rate, there were quite a few things that I jotted down in terms of notes and what have you. I'll get the callers first and kind of sprinkle in my commentary as we go. A lot of this should sound applicable to racism, white supremacy. I will put it on Facebook, but I have, this book is so practical in terms of, this is a code, this is a manual. They give you, it's a short, like 2-page printout, and it's just got information. This is what you should learn. Each section of the book, this is what you should learn. These are the important points. I can put that on the Facebook page, so if you want more information, just to make sure that you're not missing any of the main points. The person that dialed in 9325, your line should be open. I'll get the other hands as I see them.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, what stood out to me at first was the very first portion when they said, if you want to get the honey, you don't kick over the beehive. And also the part about no one criticizes himself, and that it might be a good idea in your practices that you don't criticize too harshly of others. And I had to start looking at this optimistically, because in a system of white supremacy, these are the exact things that end up happening. We are constantly criticized, and these same practices that they say that one should do, we don't see that in this current system that we're under. Our current president is constantly criticized. No matter what he does, when he took office, the world economy was at stake, not only the United States economy, but the world economy. And he was handed over a situation that was desperate. And whether he made the right choices or not, he made decisions that evidently allowed us to recover. But even with that, he's constantly criticized, and he's never given credit for anything that he does. The part about Taft, President Taft, they said he cried when Roosevelt criticized him. Well, if you do some study on President Taft, he was over 300 pounds, and President Taft was a rebel rouser. He was a gambler. He drank a lot, and he's a pretty tough character. I have a problem seeing him crying over somebody criticizing him for what he did during his presidency. Matter of fact, Taft was so big that when they had his funeral, they had to custom build his casket, and he's buried today in Arlington Cemetery. And it took, you know, I don't know.
About 8 men?
Yeah, probably about 8 men as pallbearers to carry his casket. But Abraham Lincoln You know, we all have good thoughts about Abraham Lincoln, but to think about the fact that he wrote letters criticizing people and then left them on their doorsteps and dropped letters throughout the countryside criticizing others, that's news, and I wouldn't doubt it, because it seems that people rise to the occasion. They are not born with greatness. Circumstances seem to cause them to make decisions that allow them to look as though they were great. And I think that at first I had reservations about the book, but I think that if we look at it optimistically and we look for those things, that keys that we can identify that can allow us to at least attempt to disassemble the system of white supremacy, I think that we should learn a lot from this book. I'll mute my line so others can talk.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's one of my top books. Like, this is one of those books. I don't know if people have a favorite song or favorite book, and I see the other call. I'm opening your line up right now. But the more that you read it, or the more you listen to it, or the more you watch it, you learn more each time. You get a greater appreciation. This is one of those for me. I think this is about the third time, maybe, that I'm reading this book, and it's just with that in mind, I want you all to hold Gus to task, because I hope I read this book before the cows came back on the air in 2009. I'd read this book, and so now this is about the third time that I've read it. This book, as I love it, at the very beginning it says, "This is an action book." This is not about, "Oh, that was interesting. Yes," and then move. No, this is supposed to be, I learned and I am applying what I learned. I am changing my behavior to improve my communication, my contact with other people. So, and it's my view. This is huge. I mean, you talk about one of the integral ways that the system of white supremacy stays in place. White people have groomed us for centuries to criticize and fault find and pick on other blacks, to do the exact opposite of what he's saying should be done in this book. When they say black culture, I was thinking the other day, we should say the dozens. Anytime somebody says black culture, the first thing we should mention is name calling, because that's something that black people, we have, at least in this part of the world, my experience, we have bragged about our skill and dexterity at putting down other black people. Groomed behavior. So I want you all to hold Gus to task. If you feel like on the cows, I'm still doing a lot of criticizing of other victims of racism, then point that out. But I would hope that, you know, my appreciation for this book is on display in the archives of this program. That's number one. Number two, that is a huge lesson. I've even heard Mr. Fuller say, you can learn from racists. I totally agree. That anecdote about Abraham Lincoln, I hadn't heard that before reading this book, where he called out talking bad about some other person and got challenged to a duel. Just that right there. And I have said that before, where you would be amazed when you stop and take time to get into little squabbles and arguments with other victims of racism. You would be amazed at how far off field you can end up. This is somebody who was going to go on to be president, and all that could have been for naught just because him writing some letters talking bad about somebody, and he could have died in a duel and that would have been that. And I see that happens all the time. We get derailed with these little petty arguments with Mr. Fuller, Junior League Tony Soprano. We get derailed in that all the time. And a lot of times it's responding to being called a name or insulted, dissed, disrespected by another non-white person. I think that's another integral aspect, just learning the anecdote with Lincoln, where he has all these criticisms he's going to say, and then he decides not to say it. He tucks the letter away, puts it back in a drawer, never sends it out to talk bad about General Meade. That's going to have to be done as well. I don't think he hammers that home as much, but the importance of biting your tongue, even when you feel justified in wanting to talk bad or respond or that sort of thing, you're going to have to bite your tongue frequently, especially when it comes to other victims of racism. And that is a real, we've been trained not to do it. I'll mute my line there. The person that called in 1922, your line should be open as well. 9325, you should also be with us still.
Greetings, Gus, and all the other callers. Great book. Before I start off, I want to say I've read this book maybe 3 or 4 times before. I even have the audio version of it as well. And I feel that this book is perfect for it's perfect to practice on non-white victims of racism, white supremacy. But I also feel that when it comes to white people, although some of the messages that are in there are very instructive, I also feel that when it comes to white people, they need to be challenged. And that's, I feel like, you know, by applying these same principles for white folks, I think you end up letting them off the hook, so to speak, in terms of getting them off the hook in terms of, how should I say this? I don't know. I feel like we've been groomed to not challenge white folks. And I feel like with this book, you're not going to be able to do that if you are following most of the quote-unquote techniques that's in there. But I do think it's an excellent book to practice on all white people because just like you said, you know, we're being groomed to attack one another. And I feel like we can go a long way if we practice it amongst ourselves and use some of it on white folks, but I feel like white people need to be challenged and need to be called out, and we need to, you know, check white people when, you know, they get out of line, you know, so to speak. You know, I could be uncodified with some of the words that I'm using, but that's my only comment that I had on it. I'll mute my line.
Definitely agree that white people need to be checked. Could not agree more.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I think it was huge when I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt realized that he had the wrong fuel inside of his plane, and instead of coming back and criticizing the mechanic, he came back and told him he had confidence in him not making that mistake again, and he wanted him to service his airplane for the next flight. You know, in a case like that, you would have to be extremely arrogant or in a position that you thought that you were in a superior position in order to trust someone who who had just made a desperate error like that that could have caused life, and you put your complete confidence in the same individual for the next trip. That example, I wouldn't advise other people to take. I thought that was very huge.
Caller in Alabama should be with us also.
How everybody doing? Yeah, I don't know. I'm just like tuning in not too long ago, but so I don't know if I'm on subject or anything like that, or is it just like a pinch to a call in type of thing tonight. But I heard you say something about like how black people in America take pride in making a mockery of each other and making fun of each other and things of that nature. And when you said that, you kind of brought up a memory that I had early on in life. I think I was probably like in the fourth grade or something like that. But, you know, we call it, like in my part of the country, we call it janking. That's what we call it, janking. And, you know, everybody will be janking, you know, everybody was doing their thing. And now when you're janking, you might talk about somebody's mama, you might talk about somebody's grandmama, you might talk about somebody's brother, you might talk about them, you might talk about their daddy, you might talk about whatever. But I remember a white guy. And usually it's not a rule, but it's just something that we don't do. Most of the time in where I'm from in Alabama, we don't really jank white people. Like you said, that's what made me think of that, when you said that we brag about how much we can make fun of other black people. And we really don't. We didn't, but when we looked at it, we didn't look at it like, okay, we're not we just only focusing on black people. And we just looked at it like we don't do that with them for real, because we never used to jank them. I don't remember it anyway. But one day, a white guy called himself janking me, or like y'all said, playing the dozen. A white guy was playing the dozen with me. And he initiated it. I didn't start it, you know what I'm saying? He was coming in with it. But he spoke something negative about my great-grandmother. And I'm making a point. He spoke something negative about my great-grandmother. And I told him, I was like, well, my great-grandmother died. She dead. You know, I don't mind you making fun or just joking around, but just leave my great-grandmother out of it because she's dead. And so he continued to get on saying negative stuff about my great-grandmother. So I was like, okay. It was a thing that his sister just died. She had died of, I think she had leukemia or something like that. She just died. So I was like, okay, so you want to, I just told you not to make fun of my great-grandmother, and you want to keep doing it, so I make fun of your sister. Soon as I said something about his sister, and this is the key point why I'm bringing this up. Soon as I said something about his sister, guess who jumped in his defense? The black people. The black students jumped in his defense. And everybody rushed in to make sure that everybody told that the fact that I said something about his sister, the fact that he mentioned something about my great-grandmother and all like that was never brought up. As soon as I said something about his sister, all hell broke loose. But I know it's kind of, you know, I don't know, I just wanted to throw that in there, that what you said then kind of brought back a memory, you know, of like you said, black people, it's like playing the dozens is really for us to ridicule each other, you know. I mute my line.
Thank you for sharing, sir. Caller from a block number, your line should be open.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to bring up a couple of points in listening to this this book. I'm listening to it, but it feels like I need to listen to it from two different perspectives or contexts. the global system context and how non-white people are to view them, and also the other way of looking also within the same context, but looking at how we treat each other. I think there are two approaches to dealing with the text. I was distinctly taken in by the description of Two Gun Crowley and Al Capone, how these were, they saw themselves as being these wonderful, kind-hearted, generous, beneficent people, but that's the way most psychopaths, sociopsychopaths, malignant narcissists, that's the way they see themselves. They see themselves like that, but not in relation to what they are doing to their victims. It is important that we as non-white people, specifically non-white black people, are able to understand that that description of Two Gun Crowley and Al Capone and some of the other people that we'll come across in this book, we have to understand that that is how these individuals, these people, this collective, the global system sees itself. It doesn't see, to some extent, some of them definitely see it, others have chosen not to see, and I do mean chosen, but we have to be able to understand that that's the way they see themselves, as being basically rather harmless, even if they are skinning a black man or black woman alive. They are still considering themselves to be these wonderful, soft-hearted things. I find it difficult to describe them as people. From the other side of that, non-white people must understand that when we are interacting with each other, we have been severely damaged over hundreds and hundreds of years. So yes, what the book refers to, when it's read, don't criticize, condemn, or complain, very true. When working with our own, we do not criticize, we do not condemn, we do not complain as best we humanly can under the current system of global racism, white supremacy, that is laying everything, just destroying the planet, the people, the animals, everything. We do our level best when we are interacting with non-white people to do these things. But when it comes to dealing with the psychopath, the racist man, racist woman, racist child, we do criticize, we do condemn the behavior, and we must complain. We cannot sit by quietly any longer while they do these horrific things around the planet, because that just, when you are quiet with a psychopath or malignant narcissist, sociopath, that's what they enjoy. They thrive on the victim being quiet and compliant. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate the commentary. I definitely, with regards to the suggestions in the book, my brain computer, I take these as how I'm relating to other victims of racism. This is not, I don't take this as how I deal with my enemy, although later on in the book, some of those techniques will work for how you relate to racist suspects as well. But we haven't got that far yet. But with the initial techniques about refraining from criticism and all that, I'm thinking non-white people, although I think that's the context that I presented it in. This does not apply to white people at all. With victims, though, with what you said about Crowley, that is exactly, I think, how white... I was thinking victim the whole time. I still hear that. White people saying that they are victims. The victimizer saying that they are somehow the victim, that they have somehow been... In fact, Gloria Platko, I don't know if y'all remember when we had the guests from Michigan on the program, Buena Vista, and she was recorded, this white woman, she was recorded calling another black elected official an arrogant nigger. And she said she's a victim. She has just come out the last couple of days. She said that her whole life has been destroyed and that these two black people need to be investigated. I mean, it's the same thing that Two Gun Crowley said. Why? I mean, that's standard operating procedure. They will find a way to say that they are the victim. And I just thought that line where Two Gun Crowley, he said, this is what I get for defending myself after he's killed all these folks and been sentenced to the electric chair, that I'm just a weary heart, but a kind one, one that would do nobody any harm. That's standard line from white people. Jeffrey Dahmer all the way through. Thomas Jefferson, I wrote the Declaration of Independence. I'm not a raping pedophile. At any rate, looking at some of the other things. The other folks, if y'all have commentary, that's fine, too. I did want to just quickly check some of my notes. Oh, yeah, this is... Just keep this in mind with other victims. Even when they have done something incorrect, and all of us do, just try to keep this in mind, where he says, resist the urge... Oh, Mr. Fuller, he didn't say this. Mr. Fuller says this. I hope this will be in the updated code book. Resist the urge to criticize. I wish that would be like stop number 11. Resist the urge to criticize. Dale Carnegie writes, John Wanamaker, founder of the stores that bear his name, once confessed, I learned 30 years ago that it is foolish to scold. I have enough trouble overcoming my own limitations without fretting over the fact that God has not seen fit to distribute evenly the gift of intelligence. Wanamaker learned this lesson early, but I personally had to blunder through this old world for a third of a century before it even began to dawn upon me that 99 times out of 100, people don't criticize themselves for anything, no matter how wrong it may be. Criticism is futile because it puts a person on the defensive and usually makes him or her strive to justify him or herself. Criticism is dangerous because it wounds a person's pride, hurts her sense of importance, and arouses resentment. Very important, I think, to keep that in mind when dealing with other victims of racism, white supremacy, even victims who are defending white people. Keep that in mind. I'll mute my line if any of the other folks had anything they want to share.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Yeah, Nicola, you can go first. I'll go after you. Oh, you sure? Go ahead, man. I'll go after you. No big deal.
Okay. I just want to comment on the essay, Father Forgets, because I was listening to the caller from Alabama, and that particular essay hit home with me, because when I was growing up, my father criticized me constantly. He had a favorite saying, and my brothers even kid me to this day. He used to say, boy, if you have a lick of sense, I have $1,000,000. And that was a very hurtful t- time in my childhood, and I had to work my way through that. And even recently, when I was grown up as a grown man, you know, I had a run-in with my father, and you know, he starts to criticize, and I would tell him, you know what, you're only trying to hurt my feelings now, and that doesn't work. You can continue to do that, but I still love it. And I would leave it like that. But that particular essay had a good ending. It sounded great, but there's countless of other situations that did not end on a positive note, and that, you know, that is constantly going on, and people are constantly working through those hurtful situations. I'll mute my line.
Thank you for sharing.
My only comment that one last comment I wanted to make is that we should all keep in mind that this book was written, it was published in the 1930s, so it's very outdated, so we should all keep that in mind as well.
The other person that called from a block number, your line should be open.
Greetings. Yeah, I just wanted to co-sign somebody was talking about. Co-sign what you said, Gus. You know, I think it's when you're dealing with other victims. You know what I'm saying? And whatever the other caller said about that was in the book, criticizing young people or your child or something like that, like it does a lot of damage to them. Basically, you know, after a certain age, that type of damage is you can't even repair it, because it's in the subconscious, or you know, it's in the subconscious. So even if a person tries to succeed and things like that, they can't, because they're constantly hearing all the criticisms of the people that they looked up to. So, you know, whether they're stupid or you know, whatever the case may be, you know, you hear, and it's getting worse. You know, it's getting worse. How the parents? Because I guess the parents, I don't know, but it's getting worse. Because my parents, they didn't talk to me crazy, and I hear the parents, they talk to their kids like, you know, very tough. And the research just goes to say that stuff is in the subconscious and it doesn't get out. So even if you try to say, oh yeah, you know, I'm gonna be this codified and I'm gonna, you know, get my business together, or I'm gonna start saving my money, or I'm gonna start, man, a lot of times, depending on how rough your childhood is and how you were treated, that stuff is just like almost irreversible.
Just want to add on that really quick, to just, you know, keep in mind, under the system of white supremacy, I think all of us, avoiding racism, white supremacy, rad, not being honest about our pitiful situation, fronting, when we do that, we block out our own trauma, and I think that also makes it very easy for us to ignore, not think about, minimize the trauma that each and every non-white person victim of white supremacy on this planet has experienced. I think it's easy for us, when we think about any non-white person that's getting on our nerves for any number of reasons, that we don't like that they are having a child with this white person. We don't like that they are spending all their money on clothes and foolishness. We don't like the way that they're spending their time. We don't like that they're not reading material that we suggest, or whatever it is that they're doing that we don't like. Any number of reasons we can come up for fussing with them. We easily forget, minimize, ignore. Wow, this person has probably been criticized their entire life by everybody. Every black person in their family, every white person that they come in contact with, that's probably like 80% of the non-white people that we come in contact to. That's probably their experience. I could be exaggerating. I don't have, you know, a $50,000 study, but that's the general experience that I get, is that most non-white people have just been criticized relentlessly for all kinds of things that they have no control over, even things that they do well, and they still get criticized. It's just something to keep in mind, to really be cautious about that inertia. In fact, I said I was going to write about this inertia. I feel like the system of white supremacy, the whole physics concept of inertia, the inertia is pulling towards criticize black person, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what has taken place, criticize black person. I mean, whatever it is, you can find a reason to make a joke out of it, satire, whatever, to criticize a black person. And that's something that you, I mean, as 9-9 was saying, it gets in your subconscious. I think that's the way that we function most of the time. It's just President Obama, anybody, even ourselves. And I think that's something we really need to be mindful of. And just, if you keep a journal, if you monitor the way that you speak, really monitor how many times you're saying something that is a put down or criticism of another black person. And if you really want to be detailed, compare that to the number of times that you give a compliment or say something nice, and just see what your tally looks like at the end of the day. Is it even? Is it lopsided? I mean, just see what it looks like. I'm pretty certain if you're around a lot of black people, from what I've seen, I would not be surprised if it's in the neighborhood of 10 to 1, 10 negative comments for every one constructive comment. And I'll mute my line.
Man, it's funny that you said that. I don't want to take up no time, but man, I was just reading a study where saying that people react to negative comments 10 to 1. So, like, the negative comment would be, like, on the scale of a 10. That's how you react and you respond to it viscerally, you know. But a positive comment, like somebody says something nice to you, it's a 1 on your scale. So you don't even react to positive comments. So you got to get 10 positive comments to balance out like the one negative comment or criticism or whatever. That's even talking to yourself subconsciously, saying something about yourself. So every time you say something like, "Oh, I'm dumb," or something like that, something you did was, "Oh, that was stupid of me. I was stupid for that." You got to say 10 positive things to get the same, like just to eat, balance yourself out, like or something like what they call it, I don't know. They say acidic, and you're either acidic or whatever, but I don't know. So yeah, that's the ratio they said, 10 to 1, man, 10 to 1.
I'm not surprised. I've even heard people say that they were these are quote unquote successful people, where they said it is the negative comments, the put downs. That's what you remember. The stuff people said, something nice or what have you. And you forgot that person and whatever they said, you know, real quick. Somebody said this about you and that about you. Caller in Alabama talking about what the person said about his great grandpa. You remember that stuff for years, years and years and years, 20 years. And it will still be upset. You'll still get that visceral response. And I just feel like in this environment, I think most of us, by the time you are 15 or 20, you have already got a buildup of dogged out, talked about. I mean, it's pathetic what all of us have. I mean, it really is. It's Corbin Janae Wallace, she's not even 10, and they called her, what they call her, a cunt, and she's not even 10.
She's not gonna forget it. That's something that is gonna stick with her, unfortunately, unless she get, I guess it'll be 100 to 1 in that case, because that was public and everything, where she just gets praised for her work and everything like that, which, you know, I don't see that happening. But I mean, that's just how it goes, man. Songs remind you of the negative. You don't even think about it. I mean, we don't remember nothing about the positive, great things that we did and things that could, that really show our character. It's just the negative. All that pops up. I mean, that's a fact. So we can just leave it there. You take that for, that's plain right there. So it's, you make your choice on how you want to live. I mean,
down and relax for a minute.
Got about 8 minutes left before we start the second audio clip. Anything folks want to get in before then?
I mean, that explains the fights. That explains the fights, especially fights within the families where I could, I mean, that happens in my, I mean, you know, you would be surprised, man. Like, we are known for the family brawl. You feel what I'm saying? So, I mean, that would explain the fights, man. And the duels, you talking about pistols? I mean, family on family, man. I'm talking from knives, guns, the whole nine, man. And that could explain it right there. There's not nothing. It's powerful. When you call yourself criticizing somebody and having an opinion on them, and then forgot all the stuff that you did or all the reasons why you could be criticized, and you attack somebody, you playing with dynamite. And if you blood kin to that person, you might end up, you know what I'm saying? You might need a doctor. So, you know, I don't know. People got to grow up, man. People got to get serious, grow up. This is, and it's getting worse. You say any, these kids, you say something, these, I mean, even when I was coming up, adolescent, man, I was real sensitive to what you said. I just wasn't trying to hear nothing negative, or it could have been from adult, anybody, teacher, whatever. Like, man, I was on some violent, I wanted to hurt the person. That's how I felt like that's an explanation of, you're damaging, you're hurting people. They say, what are you playing at? That's the thing. What are you playing at? Like, what, like the caller was saying, like, you're trying to do this, or you're trying to hurt my feelings or whatever. Hurt my feelings. You know, that's your feelings. That ain't no imaginary thing. You know, that's things. So that would explain the fight. Like, people, that's just like an attack. That's like back in the day, they slap you in the face with a glove and invite you to a duel or whatever. It's just like Mr. Fuller said, like, half the time you wouldn't even say that to the person in public, so, you know, you might as well keep it to yourself. Because, you know what I mean? Like, don't do it in public or something like that. Like, I just seen some radio DJ, he got beat up for saying something over the radio. You know, you hear about that kind of stuff. He said something about a person, like, you know, it's serious. We got to get serious, man. And that would explain the fights. I wouldn't do it. It's dangerous. Period. It's dangerous to be criticized somebody, man. I don't know.
Make sure I get this in really quick as well. I wrote these down. These are just passages that I picked out that I filed all of these under. This is what domination looks like. This is what you can do. Reminded me in the code book, Mr. Fuller has a section under education where he talks about how victims of racism, they're not able to save collate, compile information over years and build on it. It gets lost and it's kind of raggedy and scattered and broken apart. And he was like, when you're in a position of dominance, you can create depositories where you save knowledge and build on knowledge and expand on it. Where he says, we were determined to spare no time, no expense to discover every practical idea that anyone had ever used throughout the ages for winning friends and influencing people. I gave the talk and urged the listeners to go out and test it in their business and social contacts, and then come back to class and speak about their experiences and the results they had achieved. What an interesting assignment. These men and women, hungry for self-improvement, were fascinated by the idea of working in a new kind of laboratory, the first and only laboratory of human relationships for adults that had ever existed. If by the time you have finished reading the first three chapters of this book, if you aren't then a little better equipped to meet life's situations, then I shall consider this book to be a total failure so far as you are concerned. For the great aim of education, said Herbert Spencer, is not knowledge, but action. This is an action book. Just that, and I mean, that's early in the book to get that. To me, that sounds like this is a manual, this is a code, a tool that should be used to go out and dominate. Just even a statement like that, to say that you've got a room full of men and women hungry for self-improvement. Wow. That is what domination looks like. I'll mute my line. We got about 2 minutes left.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to make another quick comment. Only a white person at that time would have the level of access that Mr. Dale Carnegie had, because he interviewed presidents, titans of industries, all these powerful white males, and non-white people would have been at a disadvantage to write a book like that, and to have the sort of information that would benefit non-white people at the time, So, yeah, that thought just came to my mind. Still, I share. I'm your mind.
What you said is true. It was true in 1936. It's true in 2013. And it'll be true as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I'll mute my line.
Hey, he's giving up. That's one of those books that this book you read into now. I mean, it's one of those books that, you always find if you're if you're a type of person that you find. I've got the book. I've listened to it many times. And it's in like a bundle, you can get that and this, all the audio books, but that you can readily, easily get or whatever. So I think a lot of people sleep on it, but I know that that's some serious game he's talking about right there, as far as going out and conquering the world. Even in that one movie with Sidney Poitier, where he had the children go up to the, I guess it was to get directions or whatever. You know what I'm saying? And to get a light for the cigarette and whatnot. He had the one go up, and he was like, "Hey, man, can you tell me where this, where I could get to the display?" You know, asking them the directions, but in a way where it's like no respect, and the person, I don't remember if the person gave him direction or not. And he was like, "Yeah, give me a light, man." And he didn't get no light for his cigarette. Then he had the other black male go up and, was like, "Oh, excuse me," and politeness. And, man, he was a white person. The black dude walked up to him, and it was all, it was polite. And it's actually a skill. They have a term for it. I don't know if it's Latin or what, but it's actually a skill. And he went in, he did the skill, and he got the directions, he got the light, and it was like it was I've had that happen to me, using the tools. I was glad to know him, It's so simple, but we just don't have that access. Man, you can get anything you want. This is it. I mean, not anything. You know, we want freedom. We want racism, white supremacy to be over and done with. But as far as information, and we need information, and we need right information, right knowledge. So it's a skill.
Indeed. We will move to segment number two. That we will still have a good bit of time at the end to discuss both segments of the book. Anything you didn't get to share yet, just jot it down, make some mental notes. You can share it once the second audio segment concludes. One of my favorite quotes in the book, he says it repeatedly. You're going to hear it many more times before we get done. Modesty to all, malice towards none. Keep that in mind when dealing with non-white people. Modesty to all, malice towards none. Segment number two, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Context of White Supremacy.
Chapter 2, The Big Secret of Dealing with People. There is only one way under high heaven to get anybody to do anything. Did you ever stop to think of that? Yes, just one way. And that is by making the other person want to do it. Remember, there is no other way. Of course, you can make someone want to give you his watch by sticking a revolver in his ribs. You can make your employees give you cooperation until your back is turned by threatening to fire them. You can make a child do what you want it to do by a whip or a threat. But these crude methods have sharply undesirable repercussions. The only way I can get you to do anything is by giving you what you want. What do you want? Sigmund Freud said that everything you and I do springs from two motives, the sex urge and the desire to be great. John Dewey, one of America's most profound philosophers, phrased it a bit differently. Dr. Dewey said that the deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. Remember that phrase, the desire to be important. It is significant. You're going to hear a lot about it in this book. Now, what do you want? Well, not many things, but the few things that you do wish, you crave with an insistence that will not be denied. Some of the things most people want include health and the preservation of life, food, sleep, money and the things money will buy, life in the hereafter, sexual gratification, the well-being of our children, a feeling of importance. Almost all of these wants are usually gratified, all except one. But there is one longing, almost as deep, almost as imperious, as the desire for food or sleep, which is seldom gratified. It is what Freud calls the desire to be great. It is what Dewey calls the desire to be important. Lincoln once began a letter saying, "Everybody likes a compliment." William James said, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." He didn't speak, mind you, of the wish or the desire or the longing to be appreciated. He said, "the craving to be appreciated." Here is a gnawing and unfaltering human hunger, and the rare individual who honestly satisfies this heart hunger will hold people in the palm of his or her hand, and even the undertaker will be sorry when he dies. The desire for a feeling of importance is one of the chief distinguishing differences between mankind and the animals. To illustrate, when I was a farm boy out in Missouri, my father bred fine Duroc Jersey hogs and pedigreed white-faced cattle. We used to exhibit our hogs and white-faced cattle at the county fairs and livestock shows throughout the Middle West. We won first prizes by the score. My father pinned his blue ribbons on a sheet of white muslin, and when friends or visitors came to the house, he'd get out the long sheet of muslin, he'd hold one end and I would hold the other while he exhibited the blue ribbons. And the hogs didn't care about the ribbons they had won, but Father did. These prizes gave him a feeling of importance. If our ancestors hadn't had this flaming urge for a feeling of importance, civilizations would have been impossible. Without it, we should have been just about like the animals. It was this desire for a feeling of importance that led an uneducated, poverty-stricken grocery clerk to study some law books he found on the bottom of a barrel of household plunder that he had bought for 50 cents. You've probably heard of this grocery clerk. His name was Lincoln. It was this desire for a feeling of importance that inspired Dickens to write his immortal novels. This desire inspired Sir Christopher Wren to design his Symphonies in Stone. This desire made Rockefeller amass millions that he never spent. And this same desire made the richest family in your town build a house far too large for its requirements. This desire makes you want to wear the latest styles, drive the latest cars, and talk about your brilliant children. It is this desire that lures many boys and girls into joining gangs and engaging in criminal activities. The average young criminal, according to E.P. Mulrooney, one-time police commissioner of New York, is filled with ego. And his first request after arrest is for those lurid newspapers that make him out a hero. The disagreeable prospect of serving time seems remote so long as he can gloat over his likeness sharing space with pictures of sports figures, movie and TV stars, and politicians. If you tell me how you get your feeling of importance, I'll tell you what you are. That determines your character. This is the most significant thing about you. For example, John D. Rockefeller got his feeling of importance by giving money to erect a modern hospital in Peking, China, to care for millions of poor people whom he had never seen and never would see. Dillinger, on the other hand, got his feeling of importance by being a bandit, a bank robber, and a killer. When the FBI agents were hunting him, he dashed into a farmhouse up in Minnesota and said, "I'm Dillinger." He was proud of the fact that he was public enemy number one. "I'm not going to hurt you, but I'm Dillinger," he said. Yes, the one significant difference between Dillinger and Rockefeller is how they got their feeling of importance. History sparkles with amusing examples of famous people struggling for a feeling of importance. Even George Washington wanted to be called His Mightiness, the President of the United States. And Columbus pleaded for the title Admiral of the Ocean and Viceroy of India. Catherine the Great refused to open letters that were not addressed to her Imperial Majesty. And Mrs. Lincoln, in the White House, turned upon Mrs. Grant like a tigress and shouted, "How dare you be seated in my presence until I invite you?" Our millionaires helped finance Admiral Byrd's expedition to the Antarctic in 1928 with the understanding that ranges of icy mountains would be named after them. And Victor Hugo aspired to have nothing less than the city of Paris renamed in his honor. Even Shakespeare, mightiest of the mighty, tried to add luster to his name by procuring a coat of arms for his family. People sometimes become invalids in order to win sympathy and attention and get a feeling of importance. For example, take Mrs. McKinley. She got a feeling of importance by forcing her husband, the President of the United States, to neglect important affairs of state while he reclined on the bed beside her for hours at a time, his arm about her, soothing her to sleep. She fed her gnawing desire for attention by insisting that he remain with her while she was having her teeth fixed. And once created a stormy scene when he had to leave her alone with the dentist while he kept an appointment with John Hay, his Secretary of State. The writer, Mary Roberts Reinhart, once told me of a bright, vigorous young woman who became an invalid in order to get a feeling of importance. "One day," said Mrs. Reinhart, "this woman had been obliged to face something, her age, perhaps. The lonely years were stretching ahead, and there was little left for her to anticipate. She took to her bed, and for 10 years her old mother traveled to the third floor and back, carrying trays, nursing her. Then one day the old mother, weary with service, lay down and died. For some weeks the invalid languished. Then she got up, put on her clothing, and resumed living again. Some authorities declare that people may actually go insane in order to find, in the dreamland of insanity, the feeling of importance that has been denied them in the harsh world of reality. There are more patients suffering from mental diseases in the United States than from all other diseases combined. What is the cause of insanity? Nobody can answer such a sweeping question, but we know that certain diseases, such as syphilis, break down and destroy the brain cells and result in insanity. In fact, about one half of all mental diseases can be attributed to such physical causes as brain lesions, alcohol, toxins, and injuries. But the other half, and this is the appalling part of the story, the other half of the people who go insane apparently have nothing organically wrong with their brain cells. In post-mortem examinations, when their brain tissues are studied under the highest-powered microscopes, these tissues are found to be apparently just as healthy as yours and mine. Why do these people go insane? I put that question to the head physician at one of our most important psychiatric hospitals. This doctor, who's received the highest honors and the most coveted awards for his knowledge of this subject, told me frankly that he didn't know why people went insane. Nobody knows for sure. But he did say, many people who go insane find in insanity a feeling of importance that they were unable to achieve in the world of reality. And then he told me this story. I have a patient right now whose marriage proved to be a tragedy. She wanted love, sexual gratification, children, social prestige, but life blasted all her hopes. Her husband didn't love her. He refused even to eat with her and forced her to serve his meals in his room upstairs. She had no children, no social standing. She went insane, and in her imagination she divorced her husband and resumed her maiden name. She now believes she had married into English aristocracy, and she insists on being called Lady Smith. And as for children, she imagines that she has a new child every night. Each time I call on her, she says, Doctor, I had a baby last night. Life once wrecked all her dream ships on the sharp rocks of reality. But in the sunny fantasy isles of insanity, all her barkentines race into port with canvas billowing and winds singing through the masts. Tragic? Oh, I don't know. Her physician said to me, if I could stretch out my hand and restore her sanity, I wouldn't do it. She's much happier as she is. If some people are so hungry for a feeling of importance that they actually go insane to get it, imagine what miracle you and I can achieve by giving people honest appreciation this side of insanity. One of the first people in American business to be paid a salary of over $1 million a year, when there was no income tax, and a person earning $50 a week was considered well off, was Charles Schwab. He'd been picked by Andrew Carnegie to become the first president of the newly formed United States Steel Company in 1921, when Schwab was only 38 years old. Schwab later left U.S. Steel to take over the then-troubled Bethlehem Steel Company, and he rebuilt it into one of the most profitable companies in America. Why did Andrew Carnegie pay $1 million a year, or more than $3,000 a day, to Charles Schwab? Why? Because Schwab was a genius? No. Because he knew more about the manufacture of steel than other people? Nonsense. Charles Schwab told me himself that he had many men working for him who knew more about the manufacture of steel than he did. Schwab says that he was paid this salary largely because of his ability to deal with people. I asked him how he did it. Here is his secret, set down in his own words, words that ought to be cast in eternal bronze and hung in every home and school, every shop and office in the land, words that children ought to memorize, instead of wasting their time memorizing the conjugation of Latin verbs or the amount of annual rainfall in Brazil, words that will all but transform your life and mine if we will only live by them. I consider my ability to arouse enthusiasm among my people, said Schwab, the greatest asset that I possess. And the way to develop the best that is in a person is by appreciation and encouragement. There is nothing else that so kills the ambition of a person as criticism from superiors. I never criticize anyone. I believe in giving a person incentive to work. So I'm anxious to praise, but loath to find fault. If I like anything, I am hearty in my approbation and lavish in my praise. And that is what Schwab did. But what do average people do? The exact opposite. If they don't like a thing, they bawl out their subordinates. If they do like it, they say nothing. As the old couplet says, "Once I did bad, and that I heard ever. Twice I did good, but that I heard never." In my wide association in life, meeting with many and great people in various parts of the world, Schwab declared, I've yet to find the person, however great or exalted his station, who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than he would ever do under a spirit of criticism. That, he said, frankly, was one of the outstanding reasons for the phenomenal success of Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie praised his associates publicly as well as privately. Carnegie wanted to praise his assistants, even on his tombstone. He wrote an epitaph for himself which read, "Here lies one who knew how to get around him men who were cleverer than himself." Sincere appreciation was one of the secrets of the first John D. Rockefeller's success in handling men. For example, when one of his partners, Edward T. Bedford, lost $1 million for the firm by a bad buy in South America, John D. might have criticized. But he knew Bedford had done his best, and the incident was closed. So Rockefeller found something to praise. He congratulated Bedford because he'd been able to save 60% of the money he'd invested. "That's splendid," said Rockefeller. "We don't always do as well as that upstairs." I have among my clippings a story that I know never happened, but it illustrates a truth, so I'll repeat it. According to this silly story, a farm woman, at the end of a heavy day's work, set before her menfolks a heaping pile of hay. When they indignantly demanded whether she'd gone crazy, she replied, "Well, how did I know you'd notice? I've been cooking for you men for the last 20 years, and in all that time I ain't heard no word to let me know you wasn't just eating hay." When a study was made a few years ago on runaway wives, what do you think was discovered to be the main reason wives ran away? It was lack of appreciation. And I'd bet that a similar study made of runaway husbands would come out the same way. We often take our spouses so much for granted that we never let them know we appreciate them. A member of one of our classes told of a request made by his wife. She and a group of other women in her church were involved in a self-improvement program. She asked her husband to help her by listing 6 things he believed she could do to become a better wife. He reported to the class, "I was surprised by such a request. Frankly, it would have been easy for me to list 6 things I would like to change about her. My heavens, she could have listed 1,000 things you'd like to change about me. But I didn't. I said to her, 'Let me think about it and give you an answer in the morning.' The next morning, I got up very early and called the florist and had them send 6 red roses to my wife with a note saying, 'I can't think of 6 things I would like to change about you. I love you the way you are.' When I arrived at home that evening, who do you think greeted me at the door? That's right, my wife. She was almost in tears. Needless to say, I was extremely glad I had not criticized her as she'd requested. The following Sunday at church, after she reported the results of her assignment, several women with whom she'd been studying came up to me and said, 'That was the most considerate thing I've ever heard.' It was then that I realized the power of appreciation." Florence Ziegfeld, the most spectacular producer who ever dazzled Broadway, gained his reputation by his subtle ability to glorify the American girl. Time after time, he took drab little creatures that no one ever looked at twice and transformed them on the stage into glamorous visions of mystery and seduction. And knowing the value of appreciation and confidence, he made women feel beautiful by the sheer power of his gallantry and consideration. He was practical. He raised the salary of chorus girls from $30 a week to as high as $175. And he was also chivalrous. On opening night at the Follies, he sent telegrams to the stars in the cast, and he deluged every chorus girl in the show with American Beauty roses. "I once succumbed to the fad of fasting and went for 6 days and nights without eating," It wasn't difficult. I was less hungry at the end of the sixth day than I was at the end of the second. Yet I know, as you know, people who would think they'd committed a crime if they let their families or employees go for 6 days without food, but they will let them go for 6 days and 6 weeks and sometimes 60 years without giving them the hearty appreciation that they crave almost as much as they crave food. When Alfred Lunt, one of the great actors of his time, played the leading role in Reunion in Vienna, he said, "There is nothing I need so much as nourishment for my self-esteem." We nourish the bodies of our children and friends and employees, but how seldom do we nourish their self-esteem? We provide them with roast beef and potatoes to build energy, but we neglect to give them kind words of appreciation that would sing in their memories for years, like the music of the morning stars. Paul Harvey, in one of his radio broadcasts, The Rest of the Story, told how showing sincere appreciation can change a person's life. He reported that years ago, a teacher in Detroit asked Stevie Morris to help her find a mouse that was lost in the classroom. You see, she appreciated the fact that nature had given Stevie something no one else in the room had. Nature had given Stevie a remarkable pair of ears to compensate for his blind eyes. But this was really the first time Stevie had been shown appreciation for those talented ears. Now, years later, he says that this act of appreciation was the beginning of a new life. You see, from that time on, he developed his gift of hearing and went on to become, under the stage name of Stevie Wonder, one of the great pop singers and songwriters of the 70s. Some of you are saying right now, as you hear these words, "Oh, phooey, flattery, bear oil, I've tried that stuff. It doesn't work, not with intelligent people." Of course, flattery seldom works with discerning people. It is shallow, selfish, and insincere. It ought to fail, and it usually does. True, some people are so hungry, so thirsty for appreciation that they'll swallow anything, just as a starving man will eat grass and fishworms. Even Queen Victoria was susceptible to flattery. Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli confessed that he put it on thick in dealing with the Queen. To use his exact words, he said, "spread it on with a trowel." But Disraeli was one of the most polished, deft, and adroit men who ever ruled the far-flung British Empire. He was a genius in his line. What would work for him wouldn't necessarily work for you and me. In the long run, flattery will do you more harm than good. Flattery is counterfeit, and like counterfeit money, it will eventually get you into trouble if you pass it to someone else. The difference between appreciation and flattery, that's simple. One is sincere, the other is insincere. One comes from the heart out, the other from the teeth out. One is unselfish, the other selfish. One is universally admired, the other universally condemned. I recently saw a bust of Mexican hero General Alvaro Obregón in the Chapultepec Palace in Mexico City. Below the bust are carved these wise words from General Obregón's philosophy. "Don't be afraid of enemies who attack you. Be afraid of the friends who flatter you." No, I'm not suggesting flattery. Far from it. I'm talking about a new way of life. Now, let me repeat. I am talking about a new way of life. King George V had a set of 6 maxims displayed on the walls of his study in Buckingham Palace. One of these maxims said, "Teach me neither to proffer nor receive cheap praise." Well, that's all flattery is, cheap praise. I once read a definition of flattery that may be worth repeating. Flattery is telling the other person precisely what he thinks about himself. "Use what language you will," said Ralph Waldo Emerson, "you can never say anything but what you are." If all we had to do was flatter, everybody would catch on, and we should all be experts in human relations. When we are not engaged in thinking about some definite problem, we usually spend about 95% of our time thinking about ourselves. Now, if we stop thinking about ourselves for a while and begin to think of the other person's good points, we won't have to resort to flattery so cheap and false that it can be spotted almost before it's out of the mouth. One of the most neglected virtues of our daily existence is appreciation. Somehow we neglect to praise our son or daughter when he or she brings home a good report card, and we fail to encourage our children when they first succeed in baking a cake or building a birdhouse. Nothing pleases children more than this kind of parental interest and approval. And the next time you enjoy filet mignon at the club, send word to the chef that it was excellently prepared. And when a tired salesperson shows you unusual courtesy, please mention it. Every minister, lecturer, and public speaker knows the discouragement of pouring himself or herself out to an audience and not receiving a single ripple of appreciative comment. What applies to professionals applies doubly to workers in offices, shops, and factories, and our families and friends. In our interpersonal relations, we should never forget that all our associates are human beings and hunger for appreciation. It is the legal tender that all souls enjoy. Try leaving a friendly trail of little sparks of gratitude on your daily trips. You will be surprised how they will set small flames of friendship that will be rose beacons on your next visit. Pamela Dunham of New Fairfield, Connecticut, had among her responsibilities on her job the supervision of a janitor who was doing a very poor job. The other employees would jeer at him and litter the hallways to show him what a bad job he was doing. It was so bad, productive time was being lost in the shop. Without success, Pam tried various ways to motivate this person. She noticed that occasionally he did a particularly good piece of work. She made a point to praise him for it in front of the other people. Each day the job he did all around got better. Pretty soon he started doing all his work efficiently. Now he does an excellent job. And other people give him appreciation and recognition. Honest appreciation got results where criticism and ridicule failed. Hurting people not only does not change them, it is never called for. There's an old saying that I have cut out and pasted on my mirror where I cannot help but see it every day. I shall pass this way but once. Any good, therefore, that I can do, or any kindness that I can show to any human being, let me do it now. Let me not defer nor neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again. Emerson said, "Every man I meet is my superior in some way. In that, I learn of him." If that was true of Emerson, isn't it likely to be 1,000 times more true of you and me? Let's cease thinking of our accomplishments, our wants. Let's try to figure out the other person's good points. Then forget flattery. Give honest, sincere appreciation. Be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise, and people will cherish your words and treasure them and repeat them over a lifetime, repeat them years after you have forgotten them. Principle 2. Give honest, sincere appreciation. Chapter 3. He who can do this has the whole world with him. He who cannot walks a lonely way. I often went fishing up in Maine during the summer. Personally, I'm very fond of strawberries and cream, but I found that for some strange reason, fish prefer worms. So when I went fishing, I didn't think about what I wanted. I thought about what they wanted. I didn't bait the hook with strawberries and cream. Rather, I dangled a worm or a grasshopper in front of the fish and said, "Wouldn't you like to have that?" Why not use the same common sense when fishing for people? That is what Lloyd George, Great Britain's Prime Minister during World War I, did. When someone asked him how he managed to stay in power after the other wartime leaders, Wilson, Orlando, and Clemenceau, had been forgotten, he replied that if his staying on top might be attributed to any one thing, it would be to his having learned that it was necessary to bait the hook to suit the fish. Why talk about what we want? That's childish, absurd. Of course you're interested in what you want. You are eternally interested in it, but no one else is. The rest of us are just like you. We are interested in what we want. So the only way on earth to influence other people is to talk about what they want and show them how to get it. Remember that tomorrow when you're trying to get somebody to do something. If, for example, you don't want your children to smoke, don't preach at them and don't talk about what you want, but show them that cigarettes may keep them from making the basketball team or winning the 100-yard dash. This is a good thing to remember, regardless of whether you're dealing with children or calves or chimpanzees. For example, one day Ralph Waldo Emerson and his son tried to get a calf into the barn. They made the common mistake of thinking only of what they wanted. Emerson pushed and his son pulled, but the calf was doing just what they were doing. He was thinking only of what he wanted, so he stiffened his legs and stubbornly refused to leave the pasture. The Irish housemaid saw their predicament. She couldn't write essays or books, but on this occasion, at least, she had more horse sense or calf sense than Emerson had. She thought of what the calf wanted. So she put her maternal finger in the calf's mouth and let the calf suck her finger as she gently led him into the barn. Every act you have ever performed since the day you were born was performed because you wanted something. What about the time you gave a large contribution to the Red Cross? Yes, that's no exception to the rule. You gave the Red Cross the donation because you wanted to lend a helping hand. You wanted to do a beautiful, unselfish, divine act. Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. If you hadn't wanted that feeling more than you wanted your money, you would not have made the contribution. Of course, you might have made the contribution because you were ashamed to refuse, or because a customer asked you to do it, but one thing is certain. You made the contribution because you wanted something. Harry A. Overstreet, in his illuminating book, Influencing Human Behavior, said, "Action springs out of what we fundamentally desire, and the best piece of advice which can be given to would-be persuaders, whether in business, in the home, in the school, in politics, is first, arouse in the other person an eager want. He who can do this has the whole world with him. He who cannot walks a lonely way." Andrew Carnegie, the poverty-stricken Scotch lad who started to work at 2 cents an hour and finally gave away $365 million, learned early in life that the only way to influence people is to talk in terms of what the other person wants. He attended school only 4 years, yet he learned how to handle people. And to illustrate, his sister-in-law was worried sick over her two boys. They were at Yale, and they were so busy with their own affairs that they neglected to write home and paid no attention whatever to their mother's frantic letters. Then Carnegie offered to wager $100 that he could get an answer by return mail without even asking for it. Someone called his bet, so he wrote his nephews a chatty letter, mentioning casually in a postscript that he was sending each one a $5 bill. He neglected, however, to enclose the money. Back came replies by return mail, thanking dear Uncle Andrew for his kind note, and, well, you can finish the sentence yourself. Another example of persuading comes from Stan Novak of Cleveland, Ohio, a participant in our course. Stan came home from work one evening to find his youngest son, Tim, kicking and screaming on the living room floor. He was to start kindergarten the next day and was protesting that he would not go. Stan's normal reaction would have been to banish the child to his room and tell him he just better make up his mind to go. He had no choice. But tonight, recognizing that this would not really help Tim start kindergarten in the best frame of mind, Stan sat down and thought, "If I were Tim, why would I be excited about going to kindergarten?" He and his wife made a list of all the fun things Tim would do, such as finger painting, singing songs, making new friends. Then they put them into action. We all started finger painting on the kitchen table, my wife Lil, my other son Bob, and myself, all having fun. Soon Tim was peeping around the corner. Next he was begging to participate. "Oh, no, you have to go to kindergarten first to learn how to finger paint." With all the enthusiasm I could muster, I went through the list, talking in terms that he could understand, telling him of all the fun he would have in kindergarten. The next morning, I thought I was the first one up. I went downstairs and found Tim sitting sound asleep in the living room chair. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "I'm waiting to go to kindergarten. I don't want to be late." The enthusiasm of our entire family had aroused in Tim an eager want that no amount of discussion or threat could possibly have accomplished. Tomorrow you may want to persuade somebody to do something. Before you speak, pause and ask yourself, "How can I make this person want to do it?" That question will stop us from rushing into a situation heedlessly with futile chatter about our desires.
Context of white supremacy. We will be on this book, I think, for about a month, so hopefully it will be constructive. The number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number one more time is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We have about 30 minutes left. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. The PayPal is in the top right corner. You can also follow on Twitter at Until Justice. I will throw this out. Hopefully we'll get some responses before the conclusion of the broadcast. That concluding point is critical because that's something that we are in the business of, we being victims of racism who are trying to produce justice, arousing in other victims of racism the desire to replace white supremacy with justice. That is a major part of our work. Getting other non-white people to see where they have a vested interest in being concerned about racism, working against it. What are ways that you can arouse that in other non-white people? Definitely want to hear thoughts on that. I will hit the phone lines. We should have all the people that dialed in from before. So that's male caller 9325, caller in Alabama, the female caller from a block number 909, and the caller at 5301. I think 5301 is our the new person to dial in. 5301, I don't think you've shared yet. If you want to go first, your line should be open. 5301.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'm glad to see that we're doing this book. This is actually a book that I listen to frequently. I probably listened to this book maybe about 30 times. It's a book I listen to during my commute, and it helps me quite a bit. My takeaway from the last portion was something that I had written down one of the times when I listened to the book, is to be more persuasive, you have to be less abrasive. I think that oftentimes you want to be constructive when you're talking to other victims about replacing racism with justice. And in that enthusiasm, we oftentimes don't recognize that different people are at different places. So if you find that a person is still more confused than you may currently be, oftentimes people in their zeal and their zealousness can be rather harsh to those folks, and that in turn turns them off. Even as far as introducing, you know, this show or other constructive material to people, I think that you just have to meet them where they are and encourage them, but encourage them authentically and let them know that you don't expect them to be where you are, and that it's all, that's why I call United Independent Compensatory, because it means that each individual is united in the goal of seeking justice, but we all have to make an individual effort in whatever our particular gifts or talents are.
Well said. Caller at 1922 should be with us, as well as the other folks that dialed in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I thought the part about Steve Morris and the fact that he was blind and his ears compensated for the loss of his eyes, and he was able to hear the mouse in the classroom, and he was praised for that, and then it inspired him to go on to a musical career, and that turned out to be Little Stevie Wonder. I thought that was a wonderful story, but I'm suspicious of some of these stories, but hey, it sounds good to me. I think that it could be possible.
Yeah, that was a good point. I just wanted to make this point also, kind of, you know, going along with the point you just made. This person that wrote this book, he mentioned the term public relations. He's into the, he said human relations, but he's in the public relations. He's in that Edward Bernays propaganda, public relations. It's like a million. I can't think of the word, but it's like, I guess you would say group. You know, if I remember doing some research trying to find out who he was. You know, back when I first came across this work, and yeah, all the stuff he's saying about Rockefeller and how he was so great, and you know, the people that he big up, that's not by accident. You know, these people were paid by, you know, by him to you know show him in a good light, or you know, put them in his work as, like, you know, like good people or whatever. So, you know, I just don't want nobody to get that, you know, be confused by that or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, you know, he be suspicious to do, you know, he's a racist suspect, you know, he's high level racist suspect, whatever. Like, you know, keep that in mind, and you know, you do the research, you're gonna find out, you know, why he says some things he says. So I just wanted to get out the way. But, you know, if you study his correlations and who, you know, what he was about and everything like that. Like he was in the public relations, into public relations and whatnot. You know, but I just wanted to make that clear. You know. So nobody be tripping on or not understanding exactly, like, what he's you know, who this person is. Just a little bit of background from, I'm just letting people know, like, he wasn't no angel or whatever, you know what I'm saying. Right before he mentioned Stevie Wonder, I was thinking he probably didn't think no black people was gonna read to get a hold of this work. Right before he said he did the little Stevie Wonder story, I was thinking, man, he didn't have black people in mind for this.
Oh, that's an edit, by the way. Or actually, before I even get to that, to amplify your point, because I do think that's important. I do think this book has a wealth of constructive suggestions. But, I mean, it is a white person, and I think that's also very obvious, something that you should keep in mind. Even with the example of him mentioning Theodore Roosevelt, he went off to Africa to shoot lions. I mean, that's just standard, stale Africa safari stereotypes, practice of racism, imaging of Africa as some wild land of shooting beasts. And then the same thing with Lincoln, what you said about Rockefeller and all these other white people, Charles Schwab and what have you. I'm sure Abraham Lincoln didn't pay him any money to be portrayed in a favorable light, but he's still doing it. He mentions him over and over again in glowing terms and all about this guy who was a racist and told all these racist jokes about black people and wanted to get rid of black people, send them anywhere, but having them around here. So, I mean, that's just standard. He is definitely a part a white person and doing what he's supposed to do as a white person. That's it. I do think he has a lot of great constructive suggestions. To the point about the Stevie Wonder, this book was published in 1936. Stevie Wonder was not doing all this in 1936. So I think, or it's not even I think, they say in the book, this book was edited to kind of catch it up. As the caller mentioned earlier, some of the terms and what have you were a little dated, so they made some additions. The Stevie Wonder was one of them, to make it a bit more current and to make some of the metaphors and analogies that he used a bit more in sync with the times. So I doubt he included, or I know, I mean, it's just not possible. It is an anachronism. It's out of sync chronologically, so he definitely did not mention Stevie Wonder the first time around.
For me, when I revisit this book and other books that are similar to it, I have to remain mindful that I am not the intended audience. Oftentimes when they're quoting individuals who they consider to be the great thinkers or the great personalities, whether it's Nelson Rockefeller or Einstein or Socrates, I know these people don't look like me and don't have the same cultural heritage as me. So what I do is I just remix this content to a perspective that is relevant to me. So oftentimes a lot of those individuals that they may quote or talk about, I know that there are narratives within my own cultural experience, whether it's Carter G. Woodson or, you know, any other person who has done similar or even greater things. So I think that sometimes we could be so focused on the writer and the fact that the writer is a racist suspect that you can lose sight of the fact that some of this material, you know, you have to chew the meat and spit out the bone. And you need to get what's constructive from it. And if you see a principle that is adaptable to some of the work that you're trying to do, then you adapt that principle. If you need to tweak it or remix it in a way that it is culturally relevant to what it is that you're doing, then you do so. But I think sometimes to get so blinded by the fact that the writer is a racist suspect and that much of the source material that he focuses on, many of the individuals are racist or suspected racist, I think that that sometimes can obscure the benefit of the principles that you can get from the material. I mean, because another example would be, for instance, the Bible. Lots of people don't practice Christianity for various reasons. But if you look within those 66 books and you look at many of those narratives, you are able to get principles that are applicable to your everyday life. If you're not looking at it as a historical text, if you're looking at it as allegories and things of that nature, then you can draw some inspiration, some insight, some principles that can be beneficial to you.
Just in the interest of moving the discussion forward on the book to make sure we save time, I don't think anybody here disputes that. Does anybody on the call dispute that? That's what I thought. Well said.
Well, I was going to bring up, that's what I was trying to definitely move on from that point. But I was going to say, you know, my grandpa always, he's been harping on just this lack of nourishment as far as you know, appreciation and things like that. The fact that we don't say thank you, or we make it a point to not say thank you when somebody does something for you. And, yeah, he's reminding me of that, and a lot, you know what I'm saying? And that's something that I don't know. I mean, that's we've been conditioned to. I don't even know how to say it. It's like a disrespect. It's just like a. I don't know if it's just not healthy. It's the total opposite. And you go 6 days without, you know, giving a compliment or something, or you know, it's just like people bring you stuff and or do something for you, and you don't. I think it's done on purpose. I think it's like a slap in the face. Like, it's just another way of, you know, slap, you know, just another way of just mistreating a non-white person, a black person. That's what it is. That's what I want to say. Because the way I see it, how people make it a point to not say thank you, hold the door open for them, whatever it is, you know what I'm saying? It's like, so? Would you want to thank you for that? It's just bad, man. It's bad. But he's giving up pure game, man. Pure game. He said the story he told about the wife. How the wife tried to trap the husband. That's all it was a trap. And see, we will fall for that. That right there. I'm sure many of the boys that would have popped off because of that. You know what I'm saying? So somebody done read a book and done said something. Yeah, you need to go to your husband and ask them what they want to change about you. Ooh, and they done addressed it, and the husband was like, "Oh, what? Don't even trip. I got the list already written out. Stay right there." I go, and so he's giving a game right there. Like, man, don't fall for this. Don't, you know what I'm saying? And it takes some understanding and some real understanding, some real reality, you know what I'm saying, to know that. And so that's just another piece that this book then, you know, gives the reader, in this case the listener. Don't fall for that trap. That's a trap, you know. I won't take too much time, but it's not beneficial to you. Like these things that is gonna. This is for rulers. Like he said, the person that was, you know, using these techniques are for people that's wanna rule, wanna dominate. That's what this is for. You don't understand these principles and whatnot. That's for the person that's not going to rule. That's for the person that's going to fall on his face and make the same mistakes and not understand and always want to give their opinion, and it's always a criticism and whatnot. So that's how it's just a separation of the ruler and the ruled. It's not going to make you any money. It's not gonna make you more productive, more constructive. That's a good point to understand that. So you know, it benefits you not to be that way, where you're like, oh, I'm not keeping it real. Well, that keeping it real, whatever, it's not gonna make you no money if that's what you're trying to do. And Gus, you know, you asked the question, and if anybody want to ask, but I wanted you to ask that question again because I kind of forgot some of the details of the question you asked.
Towards the end of the second audio segment, when Carnegie talks about the importance of arousing enthusiasm in others, and I was saying, if people can think, because that's our task, really, how do we arouse in other victims of racism, an enthusiasm, an interest? in racism, white supremacy, and producing justice. Like, that's really our task, to get more people interested in this, more non-white people interested in this, so that people have, you know, things that they are thinking of, ways of getting non-white people more aroused into counter-racism.
That's a big question. I would like to hear some.
Are you asking the, all the callers? I don't know. That question?
Yes.
Oh, I think you've answered that many times before, Gus. So I think the best way to do that is to ask questions and don't make any statements. You know, make less and less statements. Ask more questions. I think that's the best way. You know.
You know, it's funny. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I wasn't going to answer the question. I was just going to, but yeah, I would like to hear what you have to say.
I think that it's important to recognize that a dialogue isn't a monologue. So it's important to ask questions, but oftentimes, you know, you have to know when to speak, and then you have to know when to stop speaking and to be able to measure the points on which you can interject and take away from what people are saying to you, what needs that they may personally have, wherever they are. I think that, for instance, in trying to do my work, a lot of younger people, They don't really give a damn about, you know, personally. They don't give a damn about, you know, what happened 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years, 30 years ago, for that matter. They're focused on how is it relevant to them right here and right now. It's great to show them the Black Panther Party speeches and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and things of this nature, but for many of them, those figures are the age of their grandparents and great-grandparents. So it's not real to them, it's not relevant to them. So I think that oftentimes what happens is the message gets lost in translation when you're using old archetypes or you're using individuals who are no longer relevant to the context of life that's going on right now. So I think that oftentimes what happens and what turns off people is that a lot of the work is focused on anger and bitterness. And this show has helped me, many of the guests have helped me in terms of being more disciplined in my response, not getting emotional, not getting angry, you know, not getting into all of the excessive name calling, although I do name call from time to time. And, you know, just being a little more measured in the way in which I deal with folks so that they can see that seeking justice is logical. And it's not about screaming and yelling and all of that irrational behavior. So I think that that makes it more appealing for folks that I interact with.
Now, see, Gus, I'm pretty, now, you asked the question. You know, we had two people, you know, say, as it was a hard, as it was a difficult question or whatever, because, oopsie, there you go. I almost, but anyway, let me say this. Arousing enthusiasm. And just like the story that he told, and just like Mr. Fuller said, you know, they wanted to, it's leverage or whatever, you know what I'm saying? But in the case he used leverage, the story that he used about the child and having to go to kindergarten and whatnot, they use, that's leverage. You feel what I'm saying? That they, I mean, you know, they wanted them to go, so they played the role. You know, like they were having such a good time, like this is what kindergarten is going to be all about, this is what school is all about. which is not true. But they wanted, they used that to get what they wanted out of the child or whatever. But for us, when he goes, when he talks about the sincerity, this is, you know, the sincere and the insincere. You have to have fun in what you're doing. You have people that they say that they're doing this and they're doing that, and when you see them, they're miserable. And you ask them questions and everything, and this is what the, this is what people see. It's like, well, you know, I don't want to get into that because you're not having any fun. You don't look. And Mr. Fuller says your work is your fun. So, you know, my answer would be that if it ain't, you know, if you haven't found a way to see it, to make it fun for you, this is your work and this is what we need to be doing, it ain't gonna arouse no enthusiasm because ain't nobody gonna wanna get into nothing that's a drag. Bottom line, you know what I'm saying? And I don't, and you guys probably understand this. I mean, I do it all the time. I have a great time but I have tools. You know, I have music. I play. I have music, art. I can go in any direction. It's like a blast. And we talk. And you know, we get into serious subjects. But it's a, you know. And I think that that's important too. You got to know what you're talking about in one case, so you can have all this imagination and dynamism in what you're doing, where you can take it in different directions. And when people see that, that inspires them. And they definitely want to get into what, you know, you do. Like, you know, I have to turn people away as far as, you know, as far as my association all the time. You know, it's just like, you're not ready. You haven't done the homework. You know, I don't want to be teaching no beginners, you know, nothing. You know what I'm saying? If you're really interested in it, it seems to me like you would at least do some reading where you can come and ask some questions, like, you know, some people were talking about question asking. Like, if you come and you're just like, oh, teach me or show me or tell me about this, and you haven't, so, you know, those people get turned away, you know what I'm saying? But I think that that's what has to be done. You're going to have to make your work fun, and people are going to have to see it. You can't be fronting because that's insincere. People, I'm blessed. Yeah, no, you're not. You look terrible. I'm sorry. You know what I'm saying? Oh, this is great. I love doing this work. Man, you frowning all the time. You don't even know that. If you just look at your face, the middle of your face is a big frown, and it stays there 24/7. Every time I see you, you frowning. I mean, like, people that are enjoying themselves, they ain't got no frown on their face 24/7 talking about how much they love what they're doing. No, nobody want to be around that. So.
Could I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I would like to just add some real short into the conversation about how to entice victims of racism to become involved in counter-racism. And like the guy in the book said, you must see what the people need. Instead of trying to get them to do what you want them to do, you see what they need. And then you use that to entice them to get, you know, them to do what you want them to do. But I think Elijah Muhammad had a great idea. Great idea. To get his people, or our people, involved in counter racism. And what he did was he saw that we needed jobs, we needed money, we needed income. That's why it's so easy for the white supremacists to get us to go kill brown people in the Middle East, wherever they want us to kill non-white people at, because they know what we need. We need money. People need money, they want to go to college, you know what I'm saying? And so they want to be educated, and then they want to have money. Money more than education. So I think the main way we're going to entice people to get involved in counter-racism if we make counter-racism profitable. And do that by I think Tariq Nasheed, I think he called it group economics, you know what I'm saying? Well, we, like, like we pool our money together. See what I'm saying? And I know it sounds like a pipe dream, and it might be a pipe dream, but, you know, different organizations, you know what I'm saying? Different organizations, they have a fundraiser. If it don't be a dollar from every person, like, you know, you might got you got the RBG, you know, crew. Then you got Brother Polite crew. Then, you know what I'm saying, the Cows, you know, Gus, you got a good following on your thing, you know. Every group should have their own business. And if it's nothing but just a store on the corner that's selling Hard Rock candy or whatever like that. But that, and I'm ending with this, but that entrepreneurship spirit and that go-to readiness to earn a dollar would entice people. They'd be like, oh, look what they're doing over there. The counter-racist people, they're over there getting that money. You see what I'm saying? And I ended there. But, yeah, I want to say one more thing. But if you look at it, that's how the gangsters do it. How they involve people to go shoot people and get shot. You see what I'm saying? Don't nobody want to get shot, and don't nobody want to go shoot people. But the gangsters, they'd be like, they entice them with the money. The children grow up on porches and stoops looking at the gangsters all day like, oh, man, look at what they got. They got this. They got that. So that entices them. That's the bait. But then the hook, you know what I'm saying, is coming shortly after that, which is death, penitentiary, and et cetera, et cetera. I mute my line. Sorry if I was so long-winded.
We are at the three-hour mark. We have done our three. Oh. But hopefully we should have another 4 weeks, I think, of dialogue on this book. If it has got your brain computers rolling where you are thinking of constructive thoughts, that is wonderful. We can journal, write about it, use your ideas, save for next week. That'll be fantastic. Yeah, that's why I really, really enjoy the book. It's really gets me to think a lot. But I guess the one last thing that I'll say, he mentioned Stevie Wonder in the book, and people were saying to make it applicable, think about what their interests are, the other person that you're talking to, the victim of racism, think about what their interests are, think about what they want. That's something I try to apply a lot on the program. You can apply it in your daily existence. If it's younger non-white people, I'm telling you right now, Kanye West is the subject, or one of the subjects that I think a lot of younger people would be focused on, and he is talking about racism. Racism is being connected to his name quite a bit. That would be a pretty easy one, where you can direct some dialogue, talking about that, see what they think about that, what do they think about his music. That can be some ways to generate interest, take advantage of a topic that I think a lot of people will be focused on anyway, younger, under 35. We will be back tomorrow, Saturday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory call in. Should be grand. Looking forward. It's been a lot of different things going down this week in the news. President Obama continues to take his assaults. Patrick Ewing, he was doing an interview and said that He was going to go to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that he was there on his visit, and it was a Klan rally. Was at the same hotel. And he said that's why he decided not to go to UNC. That's why he ended up going to Georgetown, because it was a Klan rally in Chapel Hill when he went for his visit. And he was just like, no way. Racist. I mean, it's all over the place, all over the place. You cannot escape. One show in town, racism, white supremacy, forever. Again, we'll be back tomorrow. We should have, I think, 4 programs in the next 5 days. We should have Esther Stanford Kosey. She should be back with us this Monday from the UK. Talk about the hacking incident, what's been going down on that side of the planet. We should have a broadcast on Tuesday. White Male should be with us. I know the finals is going on. I think we'll be competing with Tim Duncan and LeBron James. So maybe you can use your mute button. Tune into the Cows if we're serious. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal's in the top right. Listener supported. if you think the program is constructive. Share links. Mr. Scotty Reed, Black Talk Radio Network, just got the app set up where you can access the program on your smartphone, Android, iPhone. You should be able to access it live. I put the link up on the Facebook page, Cal's group. Share, let people know. That should be make it a little easier for people to access the content. You can use that iPhone for something constructive. Tune in tomorrow. Looking forward to hearing from folks. Thanks for sharing. Let me know if you have questions, confusion, comments. You can share. Did I have any quick note I wanted to get in? Yeah, just he used the metaphor early in the book when he was talking about not whipping a child to get them to do things that you want. And I was thinking, wow, that's the same metaphor, the same way that you could talk about managing slaves on a plantation, to what 909 was talking about, the circle, the social milieu that Dale Carnegie ran in during the 1930s, which was high times for eugenics. I think Lashes had mentioned Lothrop Stoddard, Madison Grant, Margaret Sanger. That was their heyday. A lot of these folks, the Rockefellers, they were all kind of the same mindset, getting away with feeble-minded folk in the way that they viewed managing the planet. So definitely something to kind of keep in mind as we roll through. I mentioned Kanye West because also when he mentioned in the book about Emerson saying that every man is my superior in some way, Kanye West just said that in his New York Times article. He said that everybody that you see around me, they're better than me in at least one thing. It reminds me, there you go, lots of connections. You can make it real current if you're talking to folks that are younger. You want to get young people focused. Anybody want to do the prayer to wrap things up? Right on. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. See if you can reduce your number of criticisms. Make it zero if you can't at least reduce. Try to make a note of that. Just make a tally. How many times you say something negative, a criticism put down of another black person. See if you can bring that number down and increase the number of constructive things, compliments. And I would even just add this as an extra because Mr. Fuller has it in the word guide. It shouldn't be focused on the physical, just around, oh, I can easily get out 10 comments. I'll just go find 10 girls that I think are super fine. Like, I mean, that's really shallow. Even what we're connecting value with is just, you know, if it's around, you can make a sexual impression on someone or I find you physically attractive until you get a little too old or what have you. It should be more focused on this person is doing something constructive. I think that is high level complimenting of other victims of racism. This person is doing something constructive. And I want to support that, recognize it, and encourage it. I think that's something that we could do a lot more of and not just, oh, your hair looks nice today, or oh, that's a nice sweater or jacket, or you got a great new pair of sneakers there. I mean, that's... And I guess that counts for something, but I think, you know, really pointing out behaviors, things that that person is doing, much better. We'll be back tomorrow. Creator, aid us in minimizing, reducing our tendency, the inertia to fault find, nitpick, scrutinize, degrade other black people, non-white victims of racism, white supremacy. It is acting out our programming. This is centuries of black buffoonery being broadcast worldwide. This is integral to the maintenance of white supremacy for us to derive enjoyment. Reflexive enjoyment and reflexive behavior patterns of talking bad about other black people, other victims of racism, white supremacy, help to make us individuals who are hungry for self-improvement and looking forward to arousing enthusiasm amongst other victims of racism to produce justice. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Context of White Supremacy, signing out.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.